Blog Talk Radio.
Speak, drum! Tell the real story. For the people who would condemn in slavery time their brothers and sisters for being ignorant. Listen to the story the drums tell. They say, you black man should love those brothers and sisters even in death. Because that valiant struggle for life made you what you are today. So keep on growing for them, in mind, in body, and in soul.
Live from Harlem, USA, The Communicators with your host, Brother Leroy, every Saturday at 7 p.m. following The Key on Blog Talk Radio. Never forget The Key, opening doors to endless possibilities.
Welcome, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the first-class citizens of the world. To God belongs the glory, and we thank the Most High for blessing us with another day to be with you and you to be with us for the purpose of getting information and building on that, enabling ourselves and our families and our communities to live a much better life. Once again, the Communicators, it comes to you straight out of Harlem, USA. I'm Brother Leroy, known affectionately to others as Black Leroy, and I answer and respond to either title, because it is with the knowledge and wisdom and understanding of who we are that we can move further ahead quickly and with no harm to anyone else. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight, November 3rd, Blog Talk Radio, The Keys 107 Network, featuring The Communicators. This program, in the first hour, is the author of a very exciting book because it can excite the creativity in you and I, Recession-Driven Riches. Our guest in the first hour is Haru Naket. And in the second hour is Dr. Francis Kress-Welsing. In the third hour, 9 p.m., is Brother Dick Gregory. You have the opportunity to call in when we open up the lines. You have the opportunity right now to contact friends and neighbors and let them know this exciting show is on the air. 3 hours of information-filled time, enabling you to also ask questions. And at the time that we open up, 213, this is the number that you will call when we open up for questions, which will be about 15 minutes from now for our first guest, 213-943-3618, 213-943-3618. And we thank those who are listening to this program through Facebook, because your friends in going into Facebook will pick up on the fact that you're listening to the Keys 107 Network, and they'll join in, and we're happy for their presence. Well, without further ado, we're very happy to welcome once again in our second interview with Brother Heru. God bless you. Thank you, my brother, for joining us on the Communicators, the Keys 107 Network.
Well, thank you for having me back.
And we're going to start at the very beginning of this book, and the key phrase within the book is creating a different mindset, having a proper mindset to take advantage of the information opportunities and resources as a factor for achieving financial success. Now, this is regardless of whether it's recession or great times. It requires for the average person, for the person who has some creativity, some dynamic motivation within them to say, I can live a much better life than what I'm living, that they have to create a different mindset. In general, Brother Heru, what are we saddled with in terms of the average yet creative individual? What is the mindset that we're saddled with that we have to get out of and create a new mindset for success?
Well, one of the things is we have to begin to question or challenge a lot of the ideas we have centered around wealth and what it is, and also a lot of the methodologies that we've been taught or raised on, which really don't get us where we want to be. They put us just past being in a survival mode as opposed to really achieving a level of wealth. So
survival mode is just, I got my paycheck coming in. If I work hard and I do the right thing, I'll have another paycheck coming in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Well, I mean, we've all been taught go to school, get a good education so you can get a good job with benefits so you can retire with a pension and, and Social Security. And if we examine that model itself, it's an obsolete methodology, and it doesn't work. When we look at the traditional stores of wealth that we usually would accumulate over time, we would look at home equity, and we see that home equity no longer exists. We would look at long-term employment, which is, again, something that's obsolete. We would look at having a job that has benefits. Again, that's obsolete. Social Security for most of us is we're not going to recognize it when we become of age, if the age remains the same, which it probably will not. When we look at 401k savings, which we were told was a good idea, the average 401k lost 50% of its value and it's unrecoverable. So when we look at all the traditional ways we were taught to store wealth, they're gone.
And the traditional ways at the very basic level is going to school in order to have a good job, in order to qualify for a good job. You talk in the very beginning of your book to begin a mental shift to packaging your talents and your skills, your education base, as a independent contractor. Expand on that for us.
Okay, one of the things we have to understand is it is not cost effective for business to operate the way it did in the past, where you had a large group of employees, where you had a brick-and-mortar building, where you had all of these expenses. As a matter of fact, when you look at your greatest expense in any business, it's going to be personnel. And with the changes in technology and the changes, you know, that we've had in communication, transportation, you no longer need a large workforce to get the same amount of work done or to bring in the same amount of income. So what most companies are beginning to do, and this was kind of kicked off by the recession, but it was an inevitability over time, is that they're not rehiring. Even companies that are in a position to rehire are no longer rehiring large workforces. What they understand is that you need a small skeleton crew of highly skilled people, management, and you will bring in people on a case-by-case basis, a project-by-project basis. So if they're not going to hire in that manner because it's not cost-effective, then you need to put yourself in a position now to develop your skill set to be that independent contractor that's in demand. So you have to see yourself kind of like a business as opposed to being an employee now.
Okay, Brother Heru, one of the things that many of us, depending on, well, it may be generational or just may be the thoroughness in which the education system in America has set up for its citizens, especially black folks, and that is that this job notion is one thing, and we can see ourselves qualifying for a job. However, there's a smaller proportion of us, a percent of us, who can see ourselves as independent and therefore capable of packaging our skills and our knowledge base to outsource it, as you term. How do you deal with that? How do you coach people into that frame of that new frame of thinking that will enable them to survive and benefit from their talents?
Well, I think you kind of said it in the terminology when we talk about independent contractor as opposed to being dependent. We've put ourselves in a state of dependency. Our survival is predicated on someone hiring us and giving us a paycheck every single week, the same amount of money. We work the same amount of hours, someone telling us when to come in, when to have lunch, you know, et cetera. And it's really a sense of freedom to be able to move about from place to place, kind of demand the type of salary that you want. And you'll actually get paid significantly more. It's more cost effective for a business to hire you as an independent contractor because they're not responsible for your taxes. They're not responsible for Social Security. They're not responsible for paying you benefits. So the actual base salary they can give you is more than what you would get if you were dependent on a job. You also don't have to worry about that insecurity, you know, because there's no such thing as job security. You don't have to live with that insecurity of, you know, when you're going to get laid off. You will be able to set your own hours as an independent contractor. You will work as much as you want to because you have an idea in your mind how much money you need to make. So if you only work 6 months out of the year and you can support the lifestyle you want to live, then you can do that. So it's really taking hold of your freedom and letting go of that mindset of being dependent on someone for your survival.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're speaking with the author of Recession-Driven Riches. It's a paperback. It is a pathway to getting out of, let's say, whether it's an unemployment rut or whether it's underemployed rut or achieving your goal that or achieving the maximization of your talents that you innately feel, even though you're working a steady job, you may feel not fulfilled. Because there's something nagging at you that you should be doing, but you can't leave your job. This book here will enable you to begin to build a parallel pathway, in my opinion, to your job until the time when you are comfortable in either leaving or making a shift. Our guest is Haru Naket, and he is with us for another 45 minutes now. I'm looking at the concepts within the first part of the book. I want to ask you, and this relates to this last question, coaching an individual whom you see has talent, has the ability, has the experience, and can pull things off in a particular area of the business world, but they may not have the confidence that would be necessary for them to be a successful independent contractor. How have you coached individual to that first success where they see that they're able to do it and move on from there?
I think, you know, it really starts with putting a value on your time. And most people have never really placed a value on your time. What is your time really worth? You know, when we talk about resources, you can get money back, you can get assets back, but you can't get your time back. And you know, ultimately, we all want to make enough money to have our own time. So we vacation so we can have time to do nothing. We want to retire so we can have time to do nothing. So our time is an extremely valuable commodity. And when you begin to put it in that perspective, it makes sense for people because most of your day is spent doing things for someone else, for someone else's benefit, and you're not even really reaping the rewards. So what's happening is you're giving your time away and you're just surviving. And what we have to understand is when we look at the traditional ways of creating wealth, and that's through real estate investing, securities investing, or business ownership, not being self-employed, but business ownership, it gives you your time back. You don't have to sit there and be involved in it 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day, and money's coming in for the rest of your life. There's no retirement from passive income streams. And so it begins to make sense to people that I don't even have to have the skill set to be able to do it. So, for instance, I own, you know, several hostels some years back. I never worked a day in the hostels. I had employed people to work there. You know, so I sat back. I had the vision. I had the plan. I had people help me execute the plan. I had other people finance the plan. And I had other people working the plan. And I reaped the benefits of that. And I think when you put it in that context, it's easy for people to see. But each success builds more success. So you have to start with something small that you're comfortable with, whether it's taking a risk on a mutual fund and realizing that you're going to get significant rewards greater than leaving your money in a bank account. And then you start to see, wow, this is not so difficult. Money's coming in, and it's not taking me more work. It's actually less work than what I'm already doing. So it goes back to, again, that mindset of freedom and owning your time.
Okay, so what I'm hearing, this last point that you're making about that mutual fund, that is a success building block in itself to get a person into a mindset that they can invest their otherwise spending wealth. I'm using that term, and instead of buying some sneakers and some new garments, I can put my money into a mutual fund that I've researched and gotten good advice on. And once I see an income coming from that, a profit coming from that, that in itself puts me into a different mindset. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And I'll give you a concrete example. When most people who have excess money or savings stick it in a bank account, and the average bank account in America pays less than 1% interest annually, meaning for every $100 you leave in the bank for an entire year, has to sit for an entire year, you earn about a dollar. That dollar gets taxed, capital gains tax, which is 15%, so 15 cents is taken away. So for every $100 you leave in the bank, you get 85 cents at the end of the year. And some people would say, well, at least I'm not losing, but you are losing because the inflation rate is about 3.5%. So when you do the math, every day your money's sitting in a bank, you're losing. I think it's easy for people to see that. But then how do you get somebody to make the shift? Well, a simple website like Morningstar.com, where they don't sell anything. It's just a reporting site where they report on the performance of different stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and securities and things of that nature. If you went on that site and you clicked on tools and you looked up mutual fund quick rank, it would list in order of performance over 10,000 mutual funds that are available and give you every single detail that you would need to make an educated decision on which one you would want to invest in. Now, when you look at the top-performing fund today, again, the bank less than 1%, the top-performing fund 1 year annualized is paying 87% return. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to say, wait a minute, less than 1%, 87%. You know, so when you begin to walk people through that process and you can show them concretely, this is what you could get for the exact same amount of effort, it doesn't make sense to continue to do something that's going to make you lose.
And I would imagine that that works extremely well, can work extremely well with teenagers, young people who are the consumers of everything that comes out new. And if you can show them and walk them through the money, let's say $300 for this new pair of sneakers that's coming out, you walk them through this exercise and get them to invest in that fund. Once they gain, it can excite the tagger in them, and they can go from there.
Yeah, it's actually a lot easier to show young people how to do it, and they're much more adventurous and willing to take a chance because they feel they have less to lose. They don't have to worry about, oh, my family. They don't have to worry about, I don't have time. You know, so they're actually a lot more open to it than people who are more established and older.
Excellent. The book is Recession-Driven Riches, and our guest is Brother Haru. He's based in Brooklyn, USA. He's been teaching methods and techniques of developing the mind to make money on your own, to become independent, to be an investor. He's been very successful in getting a lot of people to become more independent or completely independent. And I'm going to the book now because the book title, Recession-Driven Riches, is based on the condition, the economic condition that we're confronted with in America. And the origin, as you lay out in your book, you say, hey, start at the beginning and let's go through this bad boy. And the origin of the bubble, the real estate bubble, just take us through the key points that we need to know and what has resulted from that that requires us to make the mental shift.
Well, one of the things, you know, we have to understand is the mindset of people. And, you know, people make actions very emotionally, and that's based on fear or greed. And fear and greed force people to make crazy decisions. And so when we look back at what happened, and we can go way back because what happened was when the Berlin Wall fell, when communism fell, there was an explosion of income that needed to be put somewhere. All of a sudden, there were communist, former communist countries that had a tremendous amount of money, and the way banks make money is by lending it. So there was a huge surplus of money that needed to be spread out over the world. Then when we move forward and we look here in America, and we can skip some of the crazy credit default swaps and all these things that, that really occurred that messed up the economy. But when Bush took office, one of the campaign promises that he made was that he would make more homeowners in America than at any other time in history, and especially in the minority community. And what he did was put pressure on the lending community to lower the standards to allow more people to get loans. So there were people who didn't necessarily qualify for loans, but they also lowered the interest rate. So initially we saw an influx of people who were refinancing, and that's a finite market. And so it spread to first-time home buyers. When you all of a sudden had an increase in available buyers, supply and demand says that the price of everything goes up. So the price of properties began to rise artificially, not because there was anything more than a greater demand. Well, another thing that Bush did was he created the American Dream Act, where he basically, and it was fraudulently, put a down payment in people's bank accounts so that the banks would see you had enough money for the down payment, and then take that back. And banks were lending based upon that, and people really didn't have the down payment. And what happened, that increased the prices some more. And what happened when you increase the prices, people couldn't afford the down payment, so 100% financing came about. That means you're paying 100% of what a property is worth in a loan. You're not putting anything of your own into it. It increased the pool of buyers, and it raised the prices. When it raised the prices, people couldn't afford the closing costs, which is about 6% of the price, so you saw 106% financing. You had to come out of pocket for nothing, but you're paying 6% more than what the property is worth. So you started out upside down. That was unsustainable. And so we saw the so-called subprime market go first because they couldn't afford it in the first place. And one thing that people didn't understand, even though the prices of real estate went up, the amount that people could pay for rent could not go up because salaries didn't go up. And so there was no way to pay the cost of the mortgage because you couldn't demand the rent, the rental income, because people couldn't afford that because the salaries didn't support it. So obviously it's unsustainable, and then you saw the trickle. You saw it first happening again in the subprime market where you would expect it to happen, but then it spilled over, you know, into the general market. So anybody who bought a property from 2005 forward lost from the day they signed the paperwork.
Okay. So the bubble, at a point in time, this thing burst.
Yes.
The real estate bubble was huge. It was the womb of the bundle mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
And when this thing went bust, the financial structure, for it had reverberations throughout the financial structure, throughout pension funds, et cetera.
Absolutely.
And that's known, if it's not known completely by the audience, they're aware of it. So it created a negative situation, quote, leading into a recession. The
right.
banks take advantage of it by saying that they would, if they fail, the whole system would go. They take advantage of this situation where they had put best. These are my words, not in your book.
Mm-hmm.
And they extract money from the government, so they don't lose.
Well, no, not all banks. Now, what people don't understand that there are about every year since the recession started, there have been an average of 100 banks closing.
Per year.
And per year, 100 banks per year from about 2008 forward have closed. And we don't hear that in the media anymore. We heard about the first and maybe the second year.
Right.
But even last year, I believe there were 95 banks that closed.
Okay.
So what happened was the bigger banks, you know, Bank of America and Citigroup and these banks, what they did was they took the money from the government, and instead of lending it again to jumpstart the economy, they bought up the smaller banks at a fraction of their cost.
Got
they
it.
Bought up all the assets of the little banks, making themselves larger.
Mm-hmm. I was citing this because that's another conversation. I was citing that just in terms of they got a positive out of a negative.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, what positives have been set up at this particular point in time? What are some of the positives that sharp investors educated to know that there are these positives that exist in the negative situation? What are some of the advantages that have been found in the current economic environment?
And I'm glad you brought that up. What we have to understand is wealth doesn't disappear. Wealth simply gets transferred from one place to another. So
let
wealth
me interrupt
is a,
you.
Sure.
Somebody got the money.
Somebody.
Somebody, right?
Right.
I'm just cutting in. I'm coming in from the street standpoint. Somebody, if it's a three-card Monte game and the money disappears from that counter, from that little card table, somebody got the money.
Absolutely.
All right.
I'm glad you emphasized that, because how you position yourself will determine whether you continue to lose or you gain from the transfer. Because we're going through the greatest transfer of wealth in U.S. history right now.
You gotta explain what that transfer of wealth is. You know,
the
audience.
Yes.
And myself, it took me a long time to understand it, but it is such a thing as a transfer of wealth.
Yes. So if we look at just in the real estate market itself, properties were bought for more than what they're worth at this point in time. And what the U.S. government did was they bailed the banks out and paid them for every toxic asset that they had, meaning that all the bad mortgages, they were compensated for. So the bank didn't lose, yet the bank still had the right to foreclose on the property. And we're having about 1 million foreclosures annually, too, by the way.
Yes.
So they had the right to foreclose on the property, take you to court, and try to take the property from you and sell it at auction. Nobody's going to buy it at auction because they're not going to pay the price that they want. So it goes on the bank's books as what you call a non-performing asset. And they have to get a non-performing asset off their books. So banks are selling them as what you call bank-owned or REOs, real estate-owned properties. And they sell them at a fraction of the price that's owed on them, 20%, 30%, 50% or under. And what they're doing now is selling them in bulk. So they're selling bulk REOs at 20 cents on the dollar, at 20% of their value. So what happened is if you buy it at 20%, that's instant equity. Wealth just transferred to someone else.
Mm.
also a way to do it before the bank forecloses on it is a thing called what we call a short sale. And anybody can approach an owner who's in distress and ask to represent them to the bank, negotiate to the bank and say the property's not worth what they paid for it. I want to get it at 50-60% of what the loan amount is. And in many cases, the bank will accept that. The problem with that is the seller is not allowed to benefit from the sale because they're selling it, the bank is taking a loss. But the person who purchases it now has a property that they paid, again, 60% of what the loan amount is, that's instant equity. So wealth can be transferred that way. You can do the same thing when you're talking about a lease with an option to buy. You can lease option the property and rent it out and bring in income over time, because right now what we have to understand, too, is cash flow is much more valuable than equity. In any down economy, cash flow is more valuable than equity because equity is only good if you can resell or borrow against the value. And because the banks aren't lending that way as freely, then it's better to get the cash flow from it. So if you did a lease or lease option and you get cash flow from it because you're getting more than what you're paying out every single month, again, your wealth is being transferred to you. And we have to understand that even when we're talking about our retirement plans, if your 401k lost value, stop putting money into it. Begin to look at the funds on Morningstar and other places where you can find them, because you can take that money out, even if you have to pay a penalty. It's better than losing, and stick that money into something that's performing. Ride it until the wheels fall off and move it to something else.
Mm-hmm. And the short sale, again, you said the seller is not allowed to benefit. Explain that piece.
Well, what happens if and it's kind of simple to understand when you look at it from the bank's perspective. If I lent you $100,000 for a property and you have somebody coming and representing you and saying they want to purchase the property from me for $60,000 and I agree to it, I'm taking $60,000 and have a $40,000 loss.
Right.
You know, you can't get money out of this deal when I'm taking a $40,000 loss.
Right.
You know, so from the bank's perspective, you know, there are ways you can help a person out. Legally, they cannot get money from the sale, but you could offer to cover their moving expenses. You could, you know what I mean? You can offer to cover certain other, but it can't be profit from the sale.
Right. I can't be, because in my language, I couldn't be finagling around to get out of the thing and wind up selling it to myself or
that
kind of thing. Okay.
Right.
Now, when we, the time is on us. We may have a break that's coming up, and our engineer will let me know. This is The Communicators. I'm Brother Leroy. Our guest online is Brother Heru, H-E-R-U, Nekhet, N-E-K-H-E-T. The book is Recession-Driven Riches, and this is on enabling oneself to change our way of thinking, see the opportunities that are there in a negative situation, and in the simple way of putting it, getting a positive out of a negative and we becoming more independent, saving our talents and ourselves and our families, and that's what this is all about. The telephone number, you have the opportunity to call in. If our engineer gives me the go-ahead, we can begin to take calls, 213-943-3618, 213-943-3618. And when we look at the table of contents of this book, it's a paperback and it's very accessible to the individual, to the average individual, and I call myself average. Here's one thing: profiting from the real estate cash, key current trends to consider, important rules to remember. You talked about, in answering this question that I posed, you talked about the transfer of wealth and how individuals might be able to, this is what I picked up as an influence, what an individual who has a little bit of money may be able to pick up a property in not too bad a shape at a fraction of the cost, and therefore they have, quote, instant equity because the value is far greater than what they have paid for. How would that individual begin to utilize that property. They could move their family in and stop paying rent at someplace else. That's one. Or they can use the property to begin to make income. That's me from my consumer standpoint. What are the areas that exist for an individual to make money in this time?
Well, one thing we have to understand, when we look at, again, key current trends, we have a significant amount of people who are unemployed. We have a significant amount of people who have lost their homes. But everybody needs a place to live. One of the things that we have to examine is the amount of programs that exist for people in need. And I'm not talking about some of the traditional things that people are like Section 8. There are thousands and thousands of different programs where people need a place to stay. For instance, when we're talking about HASA, which is people who have AIDS patients, or we have survivors of domestic violence, or, you know, there are so many other places. And those things are on an increase, too, by the way. But they don't have enough housing to house their clients. And in general, they pay more than what the fair market rent is. And so you'll get steady income. And in many cases, they'll even pay the cost of renovating the property to their standards. And in some cases, they'll even pay you a year's worth of rent up front. But that's how desperate they are. So we have to look at that. We also have to look at the fact that, you know, Manhattan is the number one most expensive place in America to live. Brooklyn is the second most expensive place to live, and that's primarily because of rent, which means that there's a significant amount of rental income you can achieve even with a traditional renter. Many people who cannot buy because of their credit situation or because they've lost a property have to rent. And so when we look at getting the short sales, there's a significant amount of cash flow that comes with that. And so when you begin to get that cash flow, you realize that you have the ability to get a second and a third and a fourth. You may not be able to quit your job with one or two properties, but when you begin to get three, four, and five, then you can replace your current income.
Okay. All right. 213-943-3618. You're welcome to join in the conversation, and you'll be speaking with Brother Haru. What is your website there, brother?
www.recessiondrivenriches.com.
As simple as that. You make it simple. That's the way. Okay. We, in the black community, we're noted for, I'm going back to one of the pieces in the beginning of the book, we're noted as being consumers, and that's the way the education system has geared black folks, and that's the way the particular existence of black people in America, and I'm going to say specifically white supremacy, has created a notion of inferiority in the black person. And psychologists and psychiatrists will point to our heavy consumption of goods to feel good, to look good, as being partly fueled by an inferiority complex. Whether one agrees to that or not, we are generally the consumers where other people make money off of us. Now, the mindset that an immigrant comes in, there was an article in the New York Times yesterday dealing with the value of immigrants in creating businesses, and all of that's well and good. And yet, black people who are born here in America have been among the most creative individuals who have hit the planet, but have not benefited from the creativity that we have generated. The point is, what is wealth, and why should we look at the category of wealth versus the category of material goods, as opposed to how we're looking at material goods in isolation now and not even looking at wealth? Tell us the value of looking at wealth and understanding wealth.
And, you know, it's extremely challenging, I think, to have people understand. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head when you said things that make us feel better, or we're caught into the aesthetics of things. And oftentimes we're not taught intergenerationally what wealth is. And so we look at celebrities, or we look at athletes, or we look at rappers and what they tell us wealth is. And they're not really wealthy, by the way, because we have to define wealth. And I define wealth by saying that it's beyond what we call financial freedom. Financial freedom is when your passive income, which means money that's not generated from a job, meets or exceeds your expenses. Wealth is the surplus of money beyond that. And so when we look at top athletes like Michael Vick, and he was one of the he was the top paid player in the NFL until he went to jail and had to file bankruptcy and lost it all and is just trying to get back on his feet now, you understand that that type of income that they have is fleeting. And the things that they have become worthless over time. They begin to diminish in value. And so you have to start early and really set the tone when your kids are young, or if you're a young adult. It's never too late, but it's easier to set that tone early so that you understand the difference of value. My children never got the latest everything because we had a discussion about what is that worth. Not does everybody want it, but what is that worth? How much did it cost to manufacture that? And what's going to be the value of that next year when you won't even look at it? And so we had those type of discussions. And if they wanted certain things, they earned it. They had a right to earn income. But then what I discovered, when they had to earn the income to pay for it, they realized that, you know what, it's really not worth paying that much for it because the amount of energy and time and effort I had to put into earning this money, I don't want to put it into that. And so we need to understand the difference between appreciation and depreciation, because we don't. You know, consumable things and things that grow, things that pay dividends and things that don't. You know, we tend to get stuck on crazy things. So even buying a new car, even if you can afford it, doesn't make sense because it depreciates most in the first 2 years. So why buy it new when in 2 years it still has the warranty on it and it's just broken in a little bit for you and, you know, it still looks good? It doesn't make sense to consume. And, you know, we can look back, you know, historically and say, well, we were forced to do it when we were segregated, and one of the biggest downfalls of desegregation was we gave it all away. We decided that we didn't want to shop in our community anymore because we had the right to go somewhere else, so we're going to give somebody else our money. We had the right to go somewhere, so we're not going to start our own business. We kind of gave that all away, just like we tend to give away our communities, and then we complain later. You know, we talk about gentrification, but who sold the property? You know, when you inherited a property from grandma and you didn't take care of it and you let it run down, and then somebody offered you some cash and you gave it away because you don't understand long-term economic value, and you just want that cash in hand, and the cash is depreciating every single day. The value of the dollar is declining every single day, but you want the cash in hand instead of having the property. You can't afford to build a brownstone today so it has long-term economic value, but you give them away.
Haru, you started out in the business world as a employee at a couple of companies, et cetera, with varying degrees of success. What made you turn around and began to teach what you had learned, where others say, I learned the hard way, they can let these other people learn on their own. I don't have any commitment to anybody else but my family. What made you turn around and become a master teacher?
Well, I mean, I grew up in East New York, Brooklyn, and I know people who know Brooklyn know that's probably the most economically depressed area in Brooklyn, if not in New York City. And I lost a lot of friends, and not to jail, to death. And we were all bright. We were all, you know, enthusiastic when we were young. But they got to a point where there was hopelessness for a lot of people. And initially, my way to give back was I was an educator. I was a teacher. I went back to East New York, and I taught at a very challenging school where the kids were basically thrown away. There was a special school for kids who had emotional challenges. But I didn't feel it was enough for me, for my family, so I wanted more. But then I also felt the obligation to reach back to a very underserved community. Our people are never the target market or the demographic for the wealth gurus, unless it's to sell us some garbage, unless it's to enroll us in some, you know, get-rich-quick scheme. And nobody's really giving us the truth, the lowdown about how the entire system works. You can't tell somebody how to make money if you don't tell them how the entire system works. And so nobody's telling you the rules of the game, so you can't figure out why you're always losing. So I feel if we really want to equal the playing field, somebody has to go back and explain the rules, give you the support, give you the coaching, give you the tools that you need, and then you can do it on your own. And we have to understand that when you make money, it doesn't take money from somebody else. We can all make money together. There's not a win or lose type of thing. What you discover when you're out of the working game and you're into the investor game, you can create win-win situations. It's not going to take a dime out of my pocket to tell you how to make money. As a matter of fact, I'll probably make more money because we'll probably end up doing business together.
And on top of that, there are referrals.
Absolutely.
Hey, man, so-and-so helped me, man.
Well, I'm here now. You know, we have a relationship
so-and-so
now.
Telephone number 213-943-3618. 213-943-3618. We're speaking with Brother Haru, and he's the author of Recession-Driven Riches. And this is not a pie-in-the-sky situation, which can also be whatever is in the eye of the beholder. But at the very basic level, if you can learn some skills or techniques for developing some skills that will put just a little bit more money into your pockets than what you had before, then that's on the pathway of becoming super rich. I'm not dealing with billionaire thing. I'm talking about living comfortably and enabling your family to live a much better life. 213-943-3618. You'll be on the air with Brother Haru. And when we talk about one of the building blocks for handling success, it's a chapter that comes further in your book, but it's on organization. Talk about that. Being organized, being personally organized, and the building blocks within that principle that are necessary for anybody to begin to grow themselves and enable their families to grow.
Well, one thing we have to understand, that clutter doesn't breed success. And when you have a cluttered environment, it's usually a reflection of what's going on inside of you. And so it starts with something as simple as clearing your physical environment so that you have the calmness and the ability to think and to work and to do the things that are necessary. You have to organize your thoughts so that everything is in alignment with your success. You have to organize your time. And that's really one of the things we have to really grab a hold of, because we don't realize how much time we waste. And it's difficult to be successful if you don't put that time into it. And so when you look at your daily schedule, when it takes you maybe an hour to get ready in the morning for work, an hour to get to work, 8 hours at work, an hour to get home from work, an hour to drain off from work, you got to make dinner, you got to do all these things, and then you say, well, I'm going to put in a little time for my thing. And that little time ends up, oh, I'm too tired today, I'll do it on the weekend. And then the weekend you have to catch up on everything you have to do. You might put an hour or two at most into trying to develop your wealth, and that's not going to work. And so, you know, you have to begin to, again, once you value your time, you'll understand that, you know, you have to organize things in such a way that sometimes it pays to have somebody do some of the little things, you know. I used to, when I was 28 when I first bought my home, and I had a lawn in the backyard. And silly me, at 28, I bought a lawnmower with no engine, thinking I'll stay in shape. You know, seemed like a good idea at 28.
And plus it was cheaper, right?
Yes, it was. And I'm frugal. But by the time I got to my late 30s and into my 40s, I began to realize that's not the best use of my time and energy. And I realized that there are kids who, and I bought an electric thing for them because they like to mess with the electric thing. You know, they don't mind doing it for a small fee. And the amount of money I can make in that time is significantly more than what I would have done in the backyard. So I don't do minimum wage work anymore, not because I'm above doing minimum wage work, but because that's all it'll get me.
It'll get you lift, plus you're eating up your time. That's what you're
absolutely, absolutely.
That you can't get back. Boy, oh boy. You know, you find comedy in some things that reflect oneself. 213-943-3618. We only have a few more minutes with Brother Haru, and he's so gracious to be with us. You just came back from Detroit. What did you see? What did you pick up?
Wow. Detroit is, and it's hard to even explain the depth of despair. When you go there, you see blocks and blocks and blocks of abandoned buildings. You go downtown, and this is the only place in the world I've ever seen abandoned skyscrapers.
Damn.
Abandoned skyscrapers. You know, it's to that degree of hardship. And, you know, I talk to the people there, and they don't see any hope for the future. And anybody who's not significantly invested in it has already fled. Most people are packing their bags and leaving Detroit, and it's so bad. The city is selling properties for a dollar, and nobody wants them. So when we look at a place like that, you know, it's kind of sad because I believe it can be turned around if the effort was put into it and the resources were put into it. And all we have to do is really make Detroit the center for renewable energy. They already have factories because the auto industry was there. They already have people that are used to working in that type of industry where, you know, it's factory type of work. So they're willing to work. All you have to do is re-outfit the factories the same way they did for World War II and then after World War II. And so they have a lot of land. You can raise the buildings and build, grow corn for ethanol. There's plenty of space for wind. They can bring in that industry and make that something that makes sense for America because infrastructurally we need renewable sources of energy anyway. But they're not putting anything in place that gives people hope.
That starts at the very top.
Yes.
It starts at the very top. It starts with a vision and with those of us who have been confined to the bottom rungs in this particular society, it is strategic for us to begin to think and develop think tanks as to how we can survive this thing. If there is a non-movement at the very top to save a key city in America, then there may not be any thinking in terms of saving us except the pathway into jails, et cetera. What have you found in terms of your readings that indicate that there are black people, cross-section of blacks, I'm not talking about nationalist group, cross-section of blacks, who are thinking in terms of the survival of black people in America?
Well, I don't know if there are large groups that are thinking on that scale that have the ability to actually do it. I think when you have grassroots organizations, unfortunately, most are economically immature, politically immature, and have held on to some nostalgic concepts that are obsolete. And so it's very difficult to advance. So the people who have the connection with the people are not connected with the people who have the skills and the resources, unfortunately. And it's very difficult for the people with the skills and the resources, even when they try, because I've tried, to break into the groups that are very close knit and see somebody with those skills kind of as an outsider. You know?
Yeah.
So yeah,
you're not one of us.
Right. Right.
You're not one of us, and you know, why should we trust you? And
right.
And blah blah blah. And people are books.
Mm-hmm.
So when you find an educated person, you are actually meeting a book.
Right.
And if you open up the page at the right point, you can get a lot of information from that section. You don't have to buy the whole book, or you don't have to embrace the whole book.
Right.
That's the concept that I have. People are books. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I try to find out what they know. Once I find out that they know something, then I try to expose them to other people. And that's what this interview is all about, exposing people to your book. It's a very important book, ladies and gentlemen. I recommend this book to you. And this is the second interview that we're doing with Brother Haru. We intend to do more based on his time. The book is Recession-Driven Riches. He is Haru, N-E-K-H-E-T. That's his last name, N-E-K-H-E-T. And his website is recessiondrivenriches.com. You give classes periodically. When is your, what are your classes, and when is the next one?
Well, I have a course that's called Insider Secrets to Financial Freedom, and it's a 7-week program that walks you through all the steps from the mindset, which is so critical, to strategically realigning all of your assets, putting things in order, putting your mindset in order. And then we walk through the wealth development stages, whether we're talking about securities investing, real estate investing, business ownership. We also cover asset protection because that's important. If somebody's going to try to take it, if you make it, and also tax strategy so you minimize your tax liability. I do the course 3 times a year. I do in the fall, the winter, and the spring. The next cycle starts in February. But if I have a page on Facebook that people can just follow, Recession Driven Riches on Facebook. I put updates all the time and tips for investing or tips for minimizing losses and savings and things like that. And they can, you know, stay in contact, and, you know, it's two-way communication. They can ask me questions and also be ready for the free workshops, because I give a lot of free workshops. And what I'll do after the holidays, because we have the holidays coming up, right after the holidays I'll be having a lot of free workshops that people can attend.
Brother Haru, in today's New York Times business section, there is a half page or a third of a page on asset protection. And I would venture to say, having read it, I just skimmed it, it doesn't give too much a how-to. It talks about that there is. And I'm saying this because your book goes into detail on everything that we've discussed and that is probably in your course. So the Recession-Driven Riches book, ladies and gentlemen, is a book that you need to access. You need to get this book into your home. Begin to study it with your family, you and your wife, your great partner, and begin to conserve money and begin to realize the benefit from your own talent. Brother Haru, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And in terms of people reaching out to you, that would be by way of your website.
Yes, and they can also email me, Haru@insidersgroup.com.
Haru@insidersgroup.com. All right. All right, my brother. Thank you very much. May God continue to bless you and your family.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back with our second interview after these messages. Our second interview is with Dr. Francis Cress Welton. We're talking about racism and the upcoming election, what black people can do regarding racism in America by how you vote on Tuesday, November 6th. Stay tuned. Will be right back.
This portion of The Key was brought to us by Moon107.com. Moon 107, fashions and gifts that bring out the best in you. Moon 107 is an online retail store featuring women's and men's clothing and a gift shop. The woman's shop features stylish tunics, suits, and accessories and offers the well-dressed woman an outlet to find the perfect gift for self or for someone else. The men's shop offers classy French cuffed shirts for the well-dressed man. The gift shop offers organic skin, hair, bath accessories, and inspirational music imported from Africa, India, and Asia, as well as jewelry and accessories. Moon 107, fashions and gifts that bring out the best in you. Don't forget to visit moon107.com.
M-A-U-N 107.
Keys 107 in media partnership with Harlem's newest gem, the Mix Theater, are proud to present winner of 7 national and international film awards, Elsa, a film telling the universal story of a family in turmoil. A young woman's dream becomes an obsession in search for self, offering an insider's view of the lush island culture of Guadeloupe. Elsa is the first feature by a female director from this Caribbean island. Elsa opens shortly at the Mist Harlem, the newest venue for high-quality entertainment located at 46 West 116th Street. For ticket information on the World Wide Web, go to mistharlem.com.
Brothers and sisters, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, Student Minister Abdul Hafiz Muhammad, and the believers cordially invite you to visit Muhammad's Mosque No. 7, located at 106-8 West 127th Street, Harlem, New York, between Adam Clayton Powell and Malcolm X Boulevards. Meeting times are Sundays, 10 o'clock a.m., Wednesdays at 8 p.m., and Juma prayer Fridays at 1:15 p.m. For more information, dial 212-865-1200. Once again, 212-865-1200 or www.mosque7.org.
This portion of The Keys was brought to you by the Entrepreneurs of New York Incorporated, a virtual entrepreneurial service agency designed to increase productivity for small businesses operating and servicing urban communities worldwide. Remember, the Entrepreneurs of New York Incorporated, ENY. You can find us on Facebook.
The Keys, unlocking the doors to unlimited possibilities.
The Keys Network is proud to present live from Harlem, USA, The Communicators with your host, Brother Leroy, every Saturday at 7 p.m. following The Keys on Blog Talk Radio. Never forget The Keys, opening doors to endless possibilities.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, the first-class citizens of the world, we thank the Most High for blessing us to be with you, you to be with us, for an opportunity to share information, to pass it on, to grow our own individual selves, our families, our communities, and humanity with the information we get on the Keys 107, and in particular, the communicators. I'm Brother Leroy, and we're very happy to introduce our second guest to you this evening, and her name is Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, one of the outstanding voices within the black community for clarity, for direction, and understanding white supremacy, what it is, what it has been, and also so-called black inferiority. My sister, thank you for joining us, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing.
I'm very glad to be with you, Brother Leroy.
Thank you for taking out your busy schedule time to be with us. And we're talking about racism and the upcoming election. One of the things that has been very evident to me anyway, in this election process has been the slights that have been directed towards President Barack Obama and the terms lazy, the term not understanding what America is about, implying that he's about something else and that he's not American, that he's not a Christian, that he's all these other things that make it comfortable for them to block him or try to block him from his second term. I'm not so much interested in their intentions as much as what we have to buy into for our own survival. That's me personally. Dr. Francis Quest Welsing, what are your observations regarding this current pathway to the next election of the next president of the United States?
Well, I see this very important election as a critical turning point, certainly for us as black people. And by that I mean that, you know, I've talked for years about the fact that we are in a total system structure of racism, white supremacy, and that that system structure is about the genetic survival of the global white minority population, that is a genetic recessive population in terms of skin coloration, by which I mean white people, and the president is an example of white genetic annihilation because his mother is white, his father was black. And any time you mix black and white together, the end product is going to be a product of color because of the genetic dominance of the ability to produce color. So even though the system is referred to as democracy, it might be referred to as capitalism, the reality is that we are in a system, total system structure of racism, white supremacy. And let me just read my definition before commenting about the election. Racism, white supremacy is the local and global power system and dynamic structured and maintained by persons who classify themselves as white, whether consciously or subconsciously determined, which consists of patterns of perception, logic, symbol formation, thought, speech, action, and emotional response, as conducted simultaneously in all areas of people activity, economics, education, entertainment, labor law, politics, religion, sex, and war, for the ultimate purpose of white genetic survival and to prevent white genetic annihilation on planet Earth, a planet upon which the vast and overwhelming majority of people are classified as non-white, meaning black, brown, red, and yellow, by white-skinned people, and all of the non-white people are genetically dominant in terms of skin coloration compared to the genetic recessive white-skinned people. So this is the context, this is the power context in which this election, just like all other elections in the past, have taken place, but it is in stark relief because when President Obama became president, you had so-called conservative Republican Tea Party whites saying that their goal objective was not to cooperate with him for the betterment of the country, but to see that this black man fails.
Right.
So that, do you see, it's racism, white supremacy is a war against black people in general, but black men in particular. And that is because it is black men who have the genetic potential to cause white genetic annihilation. Now, women carry the genetic material, but females cannot impose sexual intercourse. Do you see whether they're white, black, brown, red, or yellow? So the war is against all of us in general, but black men in particular. And so when the concept of his being elected to be president, the more conservative end of, because I say you have so-called Republicans, so-called Democrats, but these are just the opposite ends of the white supremacy political dynamic. Do you see, you have a liberal and conservative, but none of it is about the elimination of racism, white supremacy. So the very fact that people who classify themselves as white would get together and say, now what our goal objective is to see that this black man fails and to see that he has a single 4 terms and not 8 years. And so this is what all of the demeanment, this is a very intelligent black man, a very sincere person, and they refuse to cooperate with him because he is a black man. Now, unless he was, if he was a black man who was demeaning himself 100% of the time and demeaning black people, they would go along with him because he would really be making a fool of himself. That's fine. But not a black man who is serious in going about the business of being intelligent or having a goal objective. So this is what is at issue. And the challenge for us as black people is whether we can move beyond black self-hatred, which is a byproduct of the system of racism, white supremacy. Get beyond the black self-hatred. So you have a segment of our population saying, I'm not going to vote for him. He didn't do anything for me. Because they don't understand the total system construct. And see, we have been oppressed for 500 years. And that oppression taught us to hate ourselves and to hate one another. Do you see? And so it is culminated into black people listening to so-called music where people are calling themselves niggers and gangsters and thugs and dogs and bitches and hoes and freaks. Do you see? So because we don't understand the system that is driving this, we just think everything is an abstraction. Oh, that's just some so-called music out there. Oh, that's just, we don't see the connection of the dots where we would be able to see a total system structure that is really about our destruction, our annihilation. Like I say, we are on a genocide slide to the extent that we do not get to a point where we understand what we are dealing with. See, our situation is like giving a person a tennis racket and they're on a football field trying to score. And this is why we greet each other by saying, hey, what's happening? What's happening? What's happening? We keep repeating that because we are told we're in a democracy, but we keep running into a wall where we are not, where we are deprived of the same opportunities that the people who classify themselves as white have. Do you see? So that frustration then turns back on ourselves. And so we hate ourselves, we hate one another, and of course people will say, well, I don't hate myself. If I went on the television, if I went on the internet and I said, I got 3 pills, the first pill will turn you white. The second pill you take the next day, it'll give you long, straight hair. The third pill you can take on Wednesday, and it'll give you white features. Now, will I be richer than Oprah Winfrey? I will be richer than the richest person in the world because people would be sending for my product no matter how much I charge. They would be writing from Asia. They would be writing from Japan. They would be writing from China. They would be writing from all over Africa. They would be writing from all over the so-called United States and Brazil, Central America, the Caribbean. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because we have all been dominated by the system of white supremacy. And we have the virus, not even knowing that we have the virus, of black self-hate. And so that can, in other words, if somebody, you know, classifying themselves as white comes out and says, Obama is nothing, then it's always going to be a group. Yes, Master, I agree with you.
Mm.
That's how the plantations were run.
Mm.
See, you might have 200 slaves on George Washington's plantation, Thomas Jefferson's plantation, or any other slaveholder. And so you've got about maybe 6 or 10 white people on the plantation. But you've got hundreds of African people. So those people, if the self-regard, the self-love had not been stripped out of them through brutalization,
mm-hmm.
they would storm the big house
mm-hmm.
and say, we're not going to have that.
Mm-hmm.
You see, but if you beat people and you call them niggers and you tell them that they're ugly and you teach them to hate themselves and then you give them a white god, you say, this is your savior, this white man on this card, this white man on this picture. And so the brain automatically computes, well, if this is the son, the father must be white too.
Yes.
So this is the brainwashing. This is what is in our minds. And this is what makes us function against each other for the benefit of the system of racism, white supremacy. See, the vast majority of people on the planet are black, brown, red, and yellow people.
Mm-hmm.
And so for white supremacy, white people are fewer than one-tenth of the people on the planet. But they dominate the planet because they have taught the nine-tenths to hate themselves and to hate each other.
There is, in what you're saying, a number of things, and one is that the Europeans have a system for instilling into the minds of the target groups white supremacy and non-white inferiority. I'm just using that general because the Japanese and the Chinese women have fallen for that game of rounding out the eyes, et cetera, et cetera. But more specifically with us, what in your research did you find were the initial techniques for implanting in our minds black inferiority?
First of all, I say that, you know, if we go back 500 years, let's say, to Christopher Columbus, when he came out of Europe and he began white people. See, I like to be clear about the language. People who classify themselves as white.
Okay.
So we don't get mixed up with Caucasians and Europeans and then don't know who we're talking about.
Yeah.
People who classify themselves as white started coming out of Europe and circumnavigating the planet. And everywhere they landed, they found that there were colored people. And if the men had sexual relations with those women and waited around 9 months, they saw all the offspring look like the mothers. They
mm-hmm.
were colored. So they began to get the data that white could be genetically annihilated. What they didn't know or what had not learned in terms of white people going into Africa in having relationships with women of color and experiencing genetic annihilation, but they had not been all around the globe.
Mm.
And so when they saw this was what could happen, then if they did not want to disappear as white people, they had to have a system of domination that encompassed all areas of activity, as Neely Fuller said, because Neely Fuller is the first person as a black man, but not just the first black man, he's the first person to say racism, white supremacy is a total system structure for maintaining the power equation of white power over a relative non-white powerlessness on the planet. Do you see?
Mm-hmm.
So in all areas of activity, economics, education, entertainment, labor law, politics, religion, sex, and war. So they teach racism, white supremacy. When you wake up in the morning and turn on your TV, if it hasn't been on all night,
Mm-hmm.
The first images that you see are white, 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 and occasional black that looks white, 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 white. So now this is a primary inculcator of racism, white supremacy, along with all the magazines, along with all the textbooks, along with all the movies. You see, along with everything that takes place on the job, everything that takes place is dominated by the system of racism, white supremacy. So that's why I say that what they realize, well, wait a minute, we could be genetically annihilated. So we have to create and structure a system for our survival, which is no different than somebody drawing up a design and saying, I want to make this car, and so I'm going to make a factory that has all the necessary machinery in it to produce this car of this particular design.
Excellent.
So people were thinking. You see, but we have been taught, don't do too much thinking. Your thing is going to be to sing and to dance and to play ball. Don't do too much thinking. I'm going to do the thinking. The adage used to be to the slave, yours is not to reason why.
Mm-hmm.
Yours is but to do or die. See, the question why, which is why little children, when they begin to talk and to speak, they latch on to that question why.
Mm-hmm.
And older people get tired and they'll say, shut up. But they shouldn't say shut up, because that's sort of like the light switch that turns on the brain computer.
Mm-hmm.
Because the question why is about cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's thinking, cause and effect. What is producing this result?
Mm-hmm.
See, that's how I got into the interest in racism. As a psychiatrist in training, I said to myself, even though it wasn't what we were being taught, I wasn't taught anything about black people's mental health and training as a psychiatrist. Oh, no, they didn't talk about that. But I said, I'm a third-generation physician. My father's a doctor. His father was a doctor. So I'm interested, well, what's making black people mentally ill? And when I started taking the histories on black patients, although, you know, you saw white patients and black patients, but we were taught, you know, Freudian psychoanalytic theory, but my brain said that does not compute.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that's a lot of talk, but it's not answers.
Right.
And so I said, well, in black people's history is always elements of racism. So I have to find out what is racism.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we mentally ill? That's no different than saying, why are black men incarcerated? Why is there driving while black? Why is there police brutality? Why were black men lynched and castrated?
Mm-hmm.
Black men never tampered with white men's genitals.
Mm.
So why? What is causing? What is at cause? Because it's only when you find out what is that cause that you can actually work on solving the problem. See, in medicine we know that a patient comes in and says, I have a headache and I have a backache and I have a pain in my side. Now, a poor doctor will say, okay, well, here's something for your headache, here's something for your backache, and here's something for the pain in your side. A good doctor will say, okay, the patient is reporting these symptoms. Could these symptoms be related to an overriding illness? So that the illness is causing the symptoms. And so then if we understand the illness and treat or cure the illness, then we have solved the problem of the symptoms. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
See, and so it's like a good plumber. You call him into your house and you say, you know, the house is flooding. A poor plumber would say, well, where's your mop?
Yeah.
A good plumber will say, let's see the source of the water.
Mm-hmm.
Let's find the source of the water and turn it off at the source.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a funny thing to be talking about, about what's going on the East Coast, right?
Right.
And bless all the people that may be suffering from that fiasco. Mm-hmm. Do you see? But that in itself is something for us to begin to think about. Because the system of racism, white supremacy, which is a system for fewer than one-tenth of the people on the planet, maintaining control and domination of the nine-tenths, they can only do it by continuous war and killing.
Mm.
And so all of the trillions of dollars that are spent for guns and wars, that money could be spent for infrastructure.
Mm.
It could be spent on people having jobs, everybody having an excellent education, everybody having housing, no homeless people. But that's not what the system is about. The system is about white genetic survival by any means necessary, and it necessitates killing large numbers of non-white people. Just like for white genetic survival, it necessitates the incarceration of black genetic material.
Mm.
See, that's what all those prolonged sentences are about. But see, our dialogue, because we don't go to cause, because we are afraid to go to cause, because it means examining white people.
Mm.
And so if you want a job in a university, you can't really examine white people. Do you see? So all you can do is talk about, well, this many black men were incarcerated, and they have prolonged sentences, and they are incarcerated for things that white males are not incarcerated for, and on and on and on and on. But we don't understand what's the big picture. Black people have the greatest genetic potential to cause white genetic annihilation, because we have the greatest genetic potential to produce the black pigment melanin. So that has to be either killed or incarcerated or otherwise destroyed. Maybe you even destroy it by the effeminization of black men.
Yes.
See, turning black men into women.
And the promotion of that image.
See, that's being promoted. And whether or not it is being caused by chemicals, because there are chemicals that they know about, will cause, you know, male fish, female fish and amphibians to become effeminized.
Exactly.
Well, if you were fearful of white genetic annihilation and you knew of a chemical, would you put it in a Big Mac? You might.
And you could genetically target it. An article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal some years ago. It could have been in the 80s, or it could have been in the 70s, that at that time, the next area that they were looking at were genetically targeted chemical warfare or biological warfare, which would be genetically
targeted. This is,
targeted.
In other words, exactly. I say that. See, in other words, we've gone through the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, and this is where self-respect is important. Let's say if I've been trained to wish I was white, and I don't respect myself as black, then I'm not going to read and start thinking about, well, what does this have to do with me? Is this something that I'm reading that might be harmful to me and my people?
Mm.
See, if I haven't been trained to highly respect myself, see, self-respect is the most powerful weapon in the world. It's more powerful than any nuclear weapon.
Mm.
Self-respect. So that means what I read, what I look at, what I listen to, my brain computer is always processing, is this harmful to me? Is this harmful to my people? Do you see, if I'm programmed to self-hate, I'm just popping my fingers and bobbing my head in the automobile, making the car shake.
Mm-hmm.
You see, monkey see, monkey do. There's an African proverb that says, monkey was so busy doing what everybody else was doing that one day monkey cut his throat.
Now, listen, Dr. Francis Cress Wilson is our guest online. And ladies and gentlemen, this young lady has a wealth of information, a wealth of knowledge in this area. And I know that you're ready to call in and ask questions. We may have to take a short commercial break. Whichever one comes first, the callers who may be online to call in, we still have, we're just introducing this subject. Telephone number 213-943-3618, 213-943-3618. Engineer, do we have any questions in the chat room? Do we have any callers on the line?
We have Sister Hafisa on the line. Sister Hafisa, please, you're live on the communicators.
Good evening, Brother Leroy.
Good evening.
And Dr. Wesland, I just wanted to tell you that I had the honor of listening to you in Washington back in September at a breakfast, and you were speaking on mental illness, and I just thought that that was one of the best speeches. And when I was one of the ones that led the call to keep you on the stage as long as you need to be there, because it was really excellent. And I just wanted to say, like, when a person, for instance, when you were speaking earlier, you was talking about people think, you know, how they see themselves spiritually. And I know that a lot of, you know, African Americans go through changes with religion. You know, they very Jesus conscious. But what would make them, I mean, I know for myself, things got better for me when I started seeing everything connected to me, as opposed to if I read a book, whether it's a Quran or a Bible, I try to look for myself in that story, as opposed to looking for you know, that white character, and it becomes more of a oneness with me. But I find that a lot of people, which I guess because I walk to my own beat, they'll say, "Well, you don't believe in anything," but I do. I believe in me and my God spirit. Is there something so wrong with that?
No, not at all. Let me share a prayer that I wrote, what I call a liberating prayer for black people.
Mm.
And the prayer goes like this: Thou who art blacker than a trillion midnights, thou whose eyes shine brighter than a billion suns, thou whose hair doth coil tighter than a million springs, radiating all energy throughout the universe, we beseech thee, one and only one, to give us total strength to carry out thy will for the universe, to establish justice and live in peace. Now, I say that is curative because, see, we have been taught so deeply to hate black that yet, you know, it's like the people who study physics and astrology, astronomy is what I mean, and they study the universe, and out in the universe, what is the most powerful thing?
A black hole. That's right.
And what is the most powerful thing that they're now talking about is dark matter.
That's right.
Do you see?
Right.
So what we have to, we don't overcome. Let me say, if I said I'm a spiritual person, and so I was created by the force in the universe to be black.
Mm-hmm.
The force created me to be black.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I don't respect black, what kind of connection can I possibly have to the source?
You can't.
Mm.
And wow,
see, I'm so glad my grandmother was raped, great grandmother, and so I don't look black.
Mm.
See, that's the position we have been put in as a people,
without
understanding it and without realizing it. So that, you know, let's say a black person is standing looking out the window, and you know, they have, you know, 8-year-old, 6-year-old in the house, and the mother is looking out the window, and she says, "Oh, come and look at the cute little girl. Is she crystal black?"
Mm-hmm.
Tell the truth.
No, she's not.
Well, thank you for that, and I feel like I'm on the right track. Many blessings to you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
And see, CNN did a program. Anderson Cooper, remember the program some months ago when he had sort of gave the Kenneth Clark test? Or he, you know, somebody did the test with children, white children and black children.
With the dog.
And they had a little 3-year-old white boy. And the strip had the same face but different colors from black to white, just painted colors. And you ask the children, which child is ugly? And a 3-year-old white child, without hesitation, points to black.
Mm-hmm.
Which one is bad? Points to black.
Mm-hmm.
Which one is ugly? Points to black.
Mm-hmm.
Without hesitation, 3 years of age. Then they had some black children who were slightly older ask them the same questions. Which child is ugly? What did the black child point to?
Mm.
Black.
Mm.
Which one is dumb? Black. Which one is ugly? Black. Now, is the child stupid? No, that's what the child has been taught.
Mm.
And I dare say, see, somebody did that test on the majority of black children.
Hmm.
That's exactly what they would say.
Exactly. Telephone number 213-943-3618. 213-943-3618. You're tuned into blogtalkradio.com, The Keys 107. The program within the blog network, The Keys Network, is The Communicators. I'm your host, Brother Leroy. Our guest online is Dr. Francis Kress Welsing. And we're talking about racism in the upcoming election, November 6th. Now, going back to President Obama, looking at the point that you made about, okay, you said one of the positions that we were told to take in this country is shut up, listen, don't ask questions, just do what I say, be an athlete, be a singer, demean yourself, and everything will be all right. Those are the various stereotypes that are under that umbrella. President Obama is elected. What does that do to those stereotypes? What does that excite in the white supremacist head that they say, we got to stop this guy from being successful at day one? What's going on? What does he represent outside of just being a black guy?
See, President Obama, even though his mother's white, he's a black man, right? And
yes,
he selected a black woman to be his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And he has two black children, and he has his mother-in-law living in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
So he personifies a certain significant level of black self-respect.
Mm.
Because, you know, many black people, black men who think that, you know, they have arrived at a certain position, they want a white wife.
Right.
Like Neely Fuller says, when a black man is poor, he wants a job. This is under white supremacy conditioning. When a black man is poor, he wants a job. When he gets a job, he wants luxuries. When he gets luxuries, he wants a white woman. This is the programming, do you see? But it is self-respect annihilating.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a black man who is the personification of somebody who has a significant level of respect for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like destroy him, which is why November 6th, we should mark it down. November the 6th, 2012, is examination day for us as black people.
Mm-hmm.
because it is going to test what level of respect for ourselves do we have, or is black self-hatred and black envy going to rule the day by saying, I'm not going to vote for him? You understand? And it's going to be a test day for people who classify themselves as white. You see, it's going to test whether or not they will go against their own interest or whether they will have to support racism, white supremacy, and put in office a person who is obviously incompetent. But he's white. And so this is November the 6th is test day. And I encourage every black person, whether you have to crawl or however you get there, you make it to that polling place and manifest your respect for yourself as black people, because this is a turning point. You know, like the Mayan calendar said 2012, December 2012, and things were going to turn around. Well, I see it as it's a turnaround point, because from this point forward, the black people who experienced the enslavement, that's a whole nother discussion, that we have seen, we have been able to see the spectrum of behavior of people who classify themselves as white. And so the challenge, in other words, I've said racism, white supremacy is a system for white people's genetic survival. So to expect that they are going to, you know, have a dynamic that for the maximal development of black people's constitutional and genetic potential, that's not sane to think that. In other words, they created a system for their survival. Why would they create? Why would we expect them, if we understand that? No, we have not always understood that, but now we can understand it. So why would they create a system for our maximal genetic and constitutional development when that's the very thing they're afraid of? So we have to self-transform. See, even if people say, I don't know how we're going to do it. See, I enjoy looking at China Central Television because, you know, some of those television programs are about machinery and people using their brains, even 2,000, 3,000 years ago, and how people developed the tools that they needed and created things that they needed. You see, just like China is turning itself around from an impoverished country to a country that says we're not going to have poverty. Everybody's going to live decently. So we need to get into, as black people, we need to say we're going to transform ourselves. We have been taken to the lowest depths. Families in shambles. Men and women don't know how to relate to each other. Don't know how to raise their children. We just have to embrace ourselves and say, yeah, this is what white supremacy has done, but we are going to provide the corrective.
Dr. Francis,
we are going to transform ourselves. We're the parent people on the planet.
Go ahead.
The creative force of the universe made black people the mothers and fathers of everybody on this planet, including the mutations to white. We are the parent people. And I believe the Creator said, now I made you the first people. Nobody has more than you.
That's right.
Now I have had you at the highest point, and now you have been taken to the lowest depths. And I want to see whether you manifest what I put into you. Now that is our challenge. We are going to manifest what the creative force in the universe said black people are supposed to be.
Ladies and gentlemen,
what we,
our, Our number I'm sorry, ma'am. Our number is 213-943-3618. We only have a few more minutes with Dr. Francis Quest Welson. You are welcome to call in and ask your question and make commentary if you so desire. This is The Keys 107, and the program is The Communicators. Once again, our guest online is Dr. Francis Quest Welson. And when President Obama was elected, what did that do to the minds of black people in general?
Well, I think that black people didn't believe that was possible, and maybe 50 years ago I saw a cartoon in the New Yorker magazine, and it had two little boys, you know, like about 4 years old, standing by a water hydrant. And so the little black boy said to the little white boy, this is a little cartoon, I'll sell you my chance to be president for a nickel.
Wow.
So this was something that was unbelievable, that black people could do and achieve. President Barack Obama is going to go down in history, not only as being the best-looking president, but also the smartest, the most compassionate, the most caring, the most beautiful family. Do you see? So that has happened, but I think that at another level, that happened, and black people thought, because we as a whole, we're not understanding, we are in a system structure of racism, white supremacy. So the black man became president, and all of black people's problems were not solved. Well, we have to look at the whole picture. Neely Fuller says, okay, for a black person who says, well, he shouldn't be president, and Neely Fuller says, well, if not him, who, you?
Right.
Do you see, could you do any differently?
Yeah.
President Obama has received more death threats than any other president in history, probably more death threats than all the death threats that the others have received combined.
Right.
So the very fact that he's persisting and he's standing there, do you see, is a testament to his strength. And so that has happened, but now we have to get deep into an understanding that we're dealing with a total system. So now I've had black children, I'm a general psychiatrist and child psychiatrist, I've had little black children, little young children, males, who said, I want my name to be Obama, I want my name to be Barack.
Beautiful.
So that is the very image, just like the little boy who was in the White House at some signing or some ceremony, and he asked the president, can I touch your hair? Because he wanted to make certain that his hair was like the president's. I mean, I got, you know, in other words, I see it, but please, Mr. President, let me touch it.
Beautiful.
Because I'm sure he probably was in a school with some white children who had ridiculed his helix hair. See, black people, we haven't really embraced our helix hair. Our hair is not kinky or nappy. It's helix, like the DNA molecule. So this little child wanted to touch his hair, and the president was man enough to bend down and let the child touch his hair.
Question regarding yourself, Sister Frances Quest Welson. In light of what you have been teaching and promoting for a number of decades.
40 years.
40 years.
40 years.
How... And the kind of resistance that you would get within your own profession and outside your profession and among your own people, how or what were the things that enabled you to survive that pushback and maintain your position until today, even until today?
I think my parents.
Tell us about them, please.
My father was a physician. His father was a physician. And my parents were political people, left-wing people. You see, always talking about politics would take us to hear Dr. Du Bois, would take us to hear Paul Robeson. And so they were always focusing on the well-being of the race. My grandfather, my father's father, died in 1909. That's 103 years ago. He died in 1909. But my grandmother would always tell us, because she was in our home, she raised us along with my parents. And my grandmother would always say to us, your grandfather was a race man.
Yeah.
He put race first. If I heard my grandmother say that one time, she said it 10,000 times. Your grandfather was a race man. And so, you know, like you just internalize this.
Right.
What it is that you are supposed to do. What it is that you were supposed to be about, but no special ceremony. And so my parents and my grandparents and, you know, I guess all the other great-grandparents that I never knew that survived, so we could survive and do what we are supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And when you look at your patients, the over the years, and the consciousness, the black awareness, or the manifestation of inferiority, what have been changes, if any, from the 70s through the 80s, the 90s, and to this decade?
Well, you know, I may have people, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
No, that you have observed in both men, black men, and black women.
I don't know if I got the question. Okay. Say that again.
Well, okay. In terms of your handling different patient problems, mental health, et cetera.
Okay,
It could even be depression or anxiety. What have you seen change, if any, from the 70s through to this period with men, with black women?
Well, let me say this. It's like, you know, I guess I do a lot of talking. And so people have heard me talk, or they've read the ISIS papers or the Crest Theory. And I have people, whether I'm in a train station, in airport, or in the grocery store, people will come up to me and say, aren't you Dr. Wilson? You don't know me, but you saved my life.
Wow.
Based on what you wrote. Now, I never thought that what I wrote for eight other psychiatrists, black psychiatrists who were talking about racism in the late 1960s. That's the group of people that I thought might be interested in my ideas. So I never thought the ideas were going to really go all over. That just wasn't where I was coming from. They were talking about racism, and so we were talking about racism as black psychiatrists. So that's how, you know, so, but people will come up to me and that I don't even know. And say, I've had people say to me, Dr. Welsing, some stranger, Dr. Welsing, I first heard you speak 20 years ago, and I thought you were crazy.
Mm.
Now I understand what you're talking about.
Excellent. In the case of those individuals, or the incident of the individual saying, you saved my life, what dialogue occurred after that?
They just said the understanding. You help me understand. Black people keep saying, what's going on? What's happening?
Yes, yes.
What's happening? Hey, what's happening? What's the deal? Hey, what's happening? Somebody asked Louis Armstrong, say, Pops, what's happening? And they say he said, the white man is still in charge.
Oh, man.
Now, that's what we're talking about. Du Bois said what? In 1903, in his book, The Soul of Black Folks, the problem of the 20th century is the question of the color line.
Yeah.
Between the darker, the lighter and the darker races of mankind. Now, Neely Fuller, in his textbook for victims of racism, came along in the mid-century, 1954, sitting on a radar site in Japan, started thinking about, during the Korean War, started thinking about the problem. And he's the person who came up with, we are dealing with a system. In economics that is, encompasses economics, education, entertainment, labor law, politics, religion, sex, and war, covering thought, speech, and action, so that the power equation of white power over non-white powerlessness is maintained. And so I met him, heard that, and I, as a psychiatrist, I said, well, why would they do it? And that's when I added the part that they're a minority, they're genetic recessive. It's all about white genetic survival.
Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, as we conclude this interview and the directive as to what we should be doing and thinking November 6th is very clear, what might you leave us with regarding the proper education and development of our little girls and our little black boys?
Well, Neely Fuller gave a list of 10 behaviors in counter racism, and I call them the exercises in black mental health and black self-respect. And this is challenging, countering some of the negativity that has been imposed on us or internalized by us under white supremacy. Okay, stop name-calling one another. Stop squabbling with one another. Stop cursing one another. Stop snitching on one another for reasons of personal gain. Stop being discourteous to one another. Stop being disrespectful to one another. Stop stealing from one another. Stop robbing one another. Stop fighting one another. Stop killing one another. And I've added to that, stop using and selling drugs to one another. Stop making black children think that as children they can be adequate mothers and fathers. Black people need to be 30 and 35 years old before they reproduce themselves. They need to be married and committed so that they will build strong, strengthened personalities to deal with this war. So stop throwing down trash where black people live, work, and play. Stop pretending that racism, white supremacy does not exist. And stop allowing racism, white supremacy to divide the black, brown, red, and yellow majority on the planet.
Excellent.
So, see, teach, you know, stop squabbling, stop name-calling, stop cursing one another, but teach by example.
Thank you. My sister,
well, thank you very much
very,
for having me.
Very much. We are going to reach out for you again and have you black up in here. In the meantime, may God continue to bless you and your family. Thank you for joining us on the Keys 107 Network.
Okay, thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you and good night, ma'am. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. We are preparing for our third interview this evening. This will be with Dick Gregory. He loves to deal with current events and also help. And we'll be back after these messages.
Keys 107, in media partnership with Harlem's newest gym, The Miss Theater, proudly presents winner, best drama at UK's One World Media Awards, and double award winner at 2012 African Movie Academy Awards, Othello Burning, a beautiful coming-of-age drama, a gripping story of South African township kids as they discover surfing, a newfound freedom. Directed by award-winning filmmaker Sarah Bletcher, Othello Burning will open shortly at the Miss Theater in Harlem, located at 46 West 116th Street. For more information, visit World Wide Web, MissHarlem.com.
the Keys 107 Network, opening doors to endless possibilities. The Keys 107 lineup, all times reside in the Eastern Standard Time Zone. Every third Sunday, 5 o'clock p.m., mortgage modification with your host, Kenneth Whaley. Every Sunday, 8 o'clock p.m., unlawful captives, a look behind the walls of the prison industrial complex with your co-hosts, Richard Muhammad and Abdul Salam Muhammad. Mondays, 10 o'clock a.m., build your business with Greg Jones. Learn the secrets of business building. Monday, 3 o'clock p.m., the Peacekeepers Roll Call with your host, Captain Dennis Muhammad, and surprise celebrity guest featuring peacekeepers from around the globe. Question: when did Noah build the ark? Answer: before the flood. Disaster awareness for community preparedness with your host, Rudolph Muhammad, every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Respect for life with your host, Brother Leroy, every Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. Wednesday evenings at 7 p.m., creatively speaking, with your divas of culture for the black diaspora, sisters Michelle Mateer and Aisha Karifa Smart. Thursday evenings at 6 p.m., the cornerstone of the Keys Network, Keys 107, with your hosts, Sister Rafika Muhammad and Brother James Muhammad. But wait, there's more. Every Thursday at 8 p.m., Black Reconstruction with your co-host, Sister LaShawn Allen Muhammad and Brother Malik Green. Real solutions to the problems that plague the underprivileged, underserved, and forgotten. Thursday evenings at 9:30 p.m., serving educators, parents, and students. True School with your host, Shango Blake. Fridays at 2 p.m., there will be a Keys Network special marathon to always be announced. Every Saturday at 4 p.m., State of Affairs with your host, Stan Smith. Politics, economics, and cultural affairs of the Caribbean. 7 o'clock p.m. Saturday, The Communicators with your host, Black Leroy. Everything black from a black perspective. If the Keys Network isn't on your Blog Talk Radio, then your Blog Talk Radio isn't really on. The Keys 107 Network.
The Keys, unlocking the doors to unlimited possibilities.
The Keys Network is proud to present live from Harlem, USA, The Communicators with your host, Brother Leroy, every Saturday at 7 p.m. following The Keys on Blog Talk Radio. Never forget The Keys, opening doors to endless possibilities.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, the first-class citizens of the world. Once again, we thank you for listening to blogtalkradio.com, The Keys 107, the program within the Keys Network. This evening is The Communicators. I'm your host, Brother Leroy, and our guest online is a brother who has extensive experience in the human rights movement, not only in America, but throughout the world. He is a world-renowned activist. I don't like to say activist. He's a game-changer in terms of his presence, his sharpness of mind, and his intent, always on case, regarding the upliftment of people everywhere, regardless of what their backgrounds, race, creed. We're welcoming to the mics of Blog Talk Radio, The Communicators, Brother Dick Gregory. God bless you. Thank you for
God
joining
bless you,
us,
my brother. Peace and love to you, and thank you for this type of platform that you all have. I was listening to the rundown all week, and the sad part about it is that, you know, we should be locked in a room and listen to it over and over and over. You know, you heard the word third degree, right?
Yeah.
They give it over and over and over, and they make you talk. You don't do nothing with one time. You know, go out and sow some bragging rights. But no, that's what it is. You know, as a father of 10 black children, when them children hear the word dad, they don't know that's me. They say dada. I went home one day and heard my tune saying dada to the broom. And then what they pick up on, repeat, repeat. And then when they say dada and see you smile, they know something. They don't know what it is. And from that point on, they will not call a broom or nobody else dada. They saw something on your face. And that's how the brain works. You know, one day when we stop all of the craziness where we give people kudos and awards for being smart. You was born smart. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
All them people with the PhDs and all them titles, you came with that. Somebody just put a name to it. And it's the wrong name. I mean, when I was a little boy, man, I was born before the Depression. I was so glad when they said Depression, they put a name to my misery.
Mm.
Before that, I didn't know what it was. And it was going to say Depression. And I said, yeah, man, when I get over this Depression, I'll be all right. And so when you stop and think about it, here's a universal force that, you remember when you was a little boy, man, you get to running and running and running, and there's no restriction on the limits of your brain, and you get tired, and you say, time out, right?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. What's the game? No, my body just, I didn't mean to say that.
Yeah.
Time, and you sit down and rest, huh?
Yeah.
That's what the mental problems are. In your house, you ever overloaded your circuits, and that circuit breaker kicks in.
That's
to keep the house from burning down. That's what insanity is, man. The universal God force gave you a circuit breaker when the stuff get too wild and too big. Boom, and it's shut up. So now we ignore that out of ignorance. We didn't know. So we take you to the psychiatrist, and they give you all kind of drugs and make you keep going. It's like your circuit breaker break, and I come and add more plugs onto it, hook up the iron, the this and that. Now, they're not doing it being slick or clever. They don't know. They get to tamping with something that's too big for them, and all I got to do is sit down and rest. But now we got these folks that circuit broker broke, and they're running companies, man. They're on the stock market, flying planes, taking their pills. And so when you sit and you see that whole piece that's there that we make like it's something we created, I mean, DNA. You know, DNA was with us the day the first human thing was on this planet. It just took us this long to catch up with it. It was always there. And like I sit down and tell you, tonight I come to New York and say, man, I just discovered something up there. It's hot. I'm talking about the sun, like the sun just got here. And so it's kind of interesting when you sit and you listen. And so these type of information is good because I need a different type of information. As a man, I need a different type of information than a woman. As a black, I need a different type of information. As a non-black, and as a black oppressed, I need a different type. And being in America with all the disillusionment, and I mean, I just apologize to my wife. Man, we've been married 54 years. And I come through with that old man stuff that I was fed. I didn't know a woman was your wife. If she say no, it means no. I didn't know that. I thought, hey, man, you serious? I treat it just like I did my car. I didn't know that. It's my car. You know what you mean? You got a headache. And then as you grow and see the women's movement and then you start having respect for things, and then you realize, and I had to apologize, I didn't know.
Right.
You know, and so this is what's good about shows like this here. And it's good about brothers, sisters like you, because I can take a shortcut. See, I don't have to check your stuff out. I mean, I had a guy told me something the other day. And he said, you want me to get the information? You don't have to get me the information. I know what you said is right. You feel it. He was telling me about, I was telling him that Jack Johnson, greatest physical human sports in the history of the planet. And I was going on to tell him that, you know, that the King Kong is the story of Jack Johnson. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, man, why would a gorilla go to New York? Ain't no trees, and Lord no, ain't no bananas. So what a gorilla? Well, what was the gorilla doing there? Madison Square Garden was the boxing capital of the world.
Mm.
This is about Jack Johnson. Put it in New York. The white lady, huh? And so then I didn't know until Jack Healy told me. Said, you know, you know, think about how long ago that was. You know, Jack Johnson era. He said, you know, Jack Johnson was a Mormon. I said, what? Yeah, Idaho. Oh, okay. Not only do I see the white women and everything, but nothing there but white women. You know.
Right, right.
And so it was that whole. But I'm saying this to say, when you get information from folks who know how to filter it,
yes,
and see people like you, if you got on the radio and told all the stuff you know, man, the government would come and blow the radio station. So you also have to know what can, because I got to have respect when I come on your show. I have to have respect for your job. I have to respect for your humanness, huh?
Right.
And I mean, we looked at the wrestler that became the governor. He prags himself about he was a Navy SEAL.
Oh, yeah, the governor of
Minnesota, he was the governor.
So
he thought his America, the beautiful, wow. So he get his little show on conspiracy stuff, you know. And it was great for me because he said things that you and I didn't know to people who never knew it, but they respect him.
Yes.
Out of his Americanism, and he loved America, and he was a Navy SEAL. Tell that to the Taliban, huh? Navy, what that mean? General Giap, who ran the North Vietnamese Army, he wrote a book 35 years ago, and because of our white supremacy.
Go ahead.
Nobody read it.
Yep.
Here's the general that you're fixing to go to battle against. He wrote a simple book, and he was simple, man. He wore a pair of Nikes, before anybody ever heard of Nikes. So it was just a pair of sneakers to him. And a Yankee cap. You hear me? A New York Yankee cap. Now, can you imagine the head general, man, the general of the whole army, that you walk up to, and he ain't got all of those stuff on his shoulders? And all of that. And his book was called People's War, People's Army. And he said, give me an army that's willing to die, and I will destroy any army that's willing to kill. That was 35 years ago. When I got that, that was like 20 years ago. I got the book, had been out for 35 years. And this is what, you know, Americans, we go to war. See, we don't want to be honest. You know, a whole lot of black and white folks go to war now because times are bad, money's hard. And if we want to talk about patriotism. If they could find a job, they wouldn't have been there. And to show you what people think about somebody that's willing to go to war and kill somebody or be killed for something you don't even know. You know how many people over there in the Middle East and the Far East and all, they can't even spell the country they're in. They don't even know the politics of the country, right?
Yeah.
They there. Check coming home. Check coming home. And so consequently, this is about to change now. You see, I was in the military, man. I got drafted. Why? Well, when I went to the movies, we didn't have television. Huh? Do you know if a plane crashed in Afghanistan right now? In 10 minutes, those bodies is in your living room.
Yeah.
We had movies, man. You know, I'm sitting looking at a war movie, and the movie on the front line ain't got no powder puffs and no makeup. They ain't got no people there to cut and they put your hair back in place. But that's what I saw in the movies, man. And it was a sex thing. There was not one war movie. It wasn't some women involved. Not on the front line. They girlfriends and pinups on the wall and all of that. And I said, oh, man. And you know the interesting thing in the movie, if you could go and get all them old war movies, you would think ugly women didn't exist.
That's right.
All that. Let's see, there is no such thing as ugly women until you move into a system that deal with glamour. There's a big difference between glamour. Glamour comes off at night. Oh, and see, one of the interesting things, and I don't know when women are going to figure this out, but when your wife get up in the morning and she's going to, and I'm just, this is mythical, okay?
Yeah.
She's going to, she's a professor at NYU, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she gets up and she take the curlers out of her hair, huh? Take a shower, bath, and put the makeup on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she's getting dressed to go where? To work, right?
Yeah.
Okay, to work. And that's what you look like when you're going to work.
Yes.
Now, when she come home, she take all that off because she's getting ready to do what? Go to bed, right?
Right.
The reason prostitutes are so powerful, they look to me getting ready to go to bed the way my wife looked when she getting ready to go to work. And I don't realize that prostitute, she is going to work. And so I'm sitting there, I've been 54 years, my lady never put no makeup on, man. She takes that stuff off when she get home.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? And so it's that whole, the whole thing, that the war game, and then you add white supremacy to it.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, well, how come y'all over there fighting countries that we can't win, huh?
Mm.
I mean, every major white nation in the world have gone over there and tangled with the Taliban. Now, the interesting thing is they ain't got no General Motors Corporation up in them Rocky Mountains. They don't make missiles. They don't make flamethrowers. So you got to ask yourself, where they get them? I mean, they standing on the corner, man, with them shoes with no heels on the back, and an outfit don't look like curtains my mother used to put up to the window. In the mightiest nation in the history of the planet, can't get out of there. And so when you stop and think and see the downfall of America and all of them Western nations is white supremacy. And most white folk don't know what white supremacy is. Most black folk mean white supremacy is Ku Klux Klan. No way. There's a group of about 800 powerful white men that sit the temple for everything. Everything. And if all black folk disappeared, you think the planet would be happy? No, they got another group ready to take your place.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, when you think you figured something out, that little chump that you work with, they're not even worth arguing with. I was a boy when I was 17 years old, man. I had a bad job, you know. I put my age up, and I worked on the levee and dealing with the floods, man. And because I was black, nobody cared how old you was. And I'm sitting there with these white folk, man, working on the levee. Levee is a bad job. A bad job, huh? You can't outrun water, huh?
Mm.
People on the levee, they don't loan each other no money because you don't know when the next day one of them will be dead. And see, what I didn't know about floods, you know, all that stuff y'all see there last week?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, see, what happens is I didn't know that you and I can be, you know, standing out in this field and in 2 minutes, 10 feet of water come up. Why? Because the ground gets saturated, we can't take no more, it comes up out the ground.
Mm.
I didn't know that till I worked on the levee. I couldn't understand why them white folk couldn't outrun that stuff, man. Mm. So now when I see it comes up out the ground is saturated, can't take no more, right?
Mm.
What happens when you take your coffee cup and put it in the kitchen faucet and turn it on? And it takes a while for it to fill up, right?
Right.
But once it gets full, what happens? It spills right over, right?
That's right.
That's what happens with flood water when the ground gets saturated. It comes up. So now I had to figure out a way for my partners, man, because everything was segregated. We little children, man. little punks. But the money pay good. The money pay good, man, because there ain't no such thing as a child's pay and a grown person's pay. And so we sitting there, and Scott Air Base, it's a major air base outside of St. Louis in Illinois, and the black guys came up because it was segregated. I mean, segregated, yeah, all of it. And the guy said, hey, man, did you know this levee going to break? We have sandbags piled up 50 feet high. And when they go, doctor, they go. And so the guy said, look, that's going to go. We knew more about it than he did. And he said, well, let's go see that truck over there. I said, that's ours. Come on, we're not going to let you young black boys die here. Get on that truck. Now, here's what you develop when you're not playing a game, when you're honest with your information. I said to my man, I said, boo, man, somewhere we cannot wait till the water come up. It's too late. And so I said, you know what, man? We get tired, man. We just fall down in the middle of the road and go to sleep. Hmm?
Yeah.
Middle of the road. I mean, just like what y'all looked at last week. Like a battleground. All the normal stuff. Ain't no traffic out there on the highway. Everything done stopped. We just fall out on the ground and go to sleep. You wake up and it's spiders and bugs all over your body. So I said, you know what, man? It never dawned on me that they don't bite us. They don't bite us. He said, why? I said, because they're running for their life. They ain't looking for dinner. They ain't trying to suck no blood. Why are they on us? They feel something dry. Huh? If our clothes was wet, they wouldn't be on us. So that's what we use as our signal. That's why I'm alive today. When you see them bugs all over you, that means getting out of here. So them black airmen that was just being beautiful black men to some new punks said, get on. And so 3 days later, after that levee broke, and 3 days later when we got a little boat and came back in there, all of them was dead in the truck, man. They made it to the truck, and by that time, that water, just like a tsunami. And so it's out there, but if you try to blend in, and that's the problem we have had, we want to peacefully coexist with filth. And don't know we filthy. Huh? When you accept injustice, you become unjust. Huh?
Go ahead.
When you around filth, you become filthy. And when I try to show my grandchildren, it's a little paper mill outside of Dover. And all you do is just take them there one time. You ever pass the paper mill?
Yes.
There is no stench.
I can smell it. I can smell it.
Oh, yeah, okay. You can smell it. There is no stink like comes out of paper mill. But you know what? The people work there don't smell nothing. And that's where we are in America today. I don't care how pro-black we are. I don't care how we on this other thing. We don't smell the stink. All of us. And so consequently, that's human life. And so consequently, you sit and you look, and there's things inside your head. The fire department when I grew up was racist, white. Well, couldn't no Negroes get on fire, or the cops. But there was one thing that firefighters didn't do. They didn't come no slower to my house than they did to the white folks' house. They didn't come to my house with the siren off. Now, the racism might have set in after they got there. So as a little child, black and white children, one of the things you wanted for Christmas was a fire truck. I never seen a child wanted a police car for Christmas. Nobody. Even children whose father was cops, right? No police car. And so consequently, our next thing now is, see, we fixing to come to an era now where a gun ain't going to help and bitterness is not going to help and meanness is not going to help. And in other words, if I'm on my job, man, and there's a dead, rotten, dead cat, why am I bring it home, man, and show it to you?
Right.
Well, what did you do to deserve to, man? Let me tell you this here. And for the next 2 hours, man, I'm telling you about this dead thing, how bad. That's the same thing about racism. One time you explained certain things to me, but I don't want to hear what that white person did to you today. And you're not helping me. You trying to doctor on yourself because you couldn't say nothing. So the tone of your voice make me say, let me tell you what I told that cracker. So now he got to tell me because he ain't told it to nobody. So he's telling it to me. He heard what he said to that white boy for the first time. And I'm sitting there saying, wow, man, you did. What did he say? I wish he would have said something. Come on, what did he say? I wish he would have. So how am I going to solve my problems? And I'm listening to somebody lie to me about what they did. And then look at the other side of it. Let's say you got 10 children. Go back. We're going to go back 60. You got 10 children. Got a good job, a bad job, but it's a good job because you're working. And the white foreman come up and goose you in the rump, man.
That's right. That's what they do.
Leroy, and rub your head for luck.
That's what they do.
But wait a minute. But now you are a different breed. You know, you didn't come up in that Christian pool. You know? See, the Christian, we know when to shut up. You know, it's like when the young blacks start wearing their pants below their drawers and black folks start complaining. What make you all think you are the overseer of Negroes? On, I don't know if you know this, Leroy, but on January the 9th every year, them white folks in New York had that thing where they get on the subway with no pants
on.
Oh,
yeah. Right.
Huh?
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Them Negroes ain't said one word about that.
No.
About 30 years ago, the biggest thing on Saturday at the football game was white folks take off their clothes, get naked, and run across the field. They called it streaking. I ain't heard no Negro
right.
raise their voice. What make you think you the overseer of Negroes? Huh?
Mm.
You ain't going out there talking to them dope pushers.
Mm.
You ain't going out there talking about police. I can't find you when we're dealing with police brutality.
Mm.
And you had a black politician. I don't know if he was it wasn't federal. I don't know if he was a state that took out that billboard sign on Broadway. You know what it cost to rent a space on Broadway and had them little black brothers with their pants below their belt? I said, no, come on, thug. No. Put a cop up there beating some black folks. Let me see some pictures of police brutality. Go in the black community and take pictures of them dope pushers standing on the corner, which don't have their pants below their belt. Cops that will brutalize you, they don't wear their pants below their drawers. I'd love to see a picture of the ones that killed Christ and see if their pants was below their drawers. Huh? And so we say, well, wait a minute, hold it. Something ain't right about this picture. And so the mind, anytime you tell your child you got to be twice as good as a white person, now you're not telling them that to hurt them, but children hear what you say, not what you mean.
Yes.
Remember, I called my wife one day, I'm in a hurry, man, and I got a plane I'm running for, and I'm on this path. I said, tell your mother to come to the phone real quick. I want to yell at her. And I heard my daughter say, why Dad want to yell at you? I'm changing my whole life.
Mm.
They hear what you say, not what you mean.
Yeah.
So when you tell a child you got to be twice as good as a white, they hear you say they dumb. If you tell me I got to run twice as fast as the white boy, you telling me I'm slow.
Mm.
And then now they can prove it. They got a test they do. I thought UCLA, that's another test. But the Department of Education, they do all kind of research, man. And they took these blacks and whites and gave them a test. You know, good income, good family, mother and father, college. Everything was perfect. Hmm? Everything. Right side of town. And they came in and said, look, we got some extra test money here, and this test don't mean nothing. This test don't mean anything. We just got to turn them in. They won't even be graded. I'd like for you, we'll grade them, but it won't count. This will never go on your record. And they gave it to them, and all the blacks and the women and the whites in there, every one of them scored 100. Well, that was the caliber of students they had, 100. Then they took another group and gave them the same test. And said, now, they just got this to us late, but it's really important. This test will follow you for the rest of your life. It's the most important test you take. And they gave it to the same amount of black, white, women. It was a different group. Everything was the same. All the black students flunked it. Why? You got to be twice as good as a white. Mm. Hmm? That's in my head. That's in my head. Mm. Now, we need to start developing people now that can tell me how I flush this out of my head. Hmm? Mm. I mean, Bob Marley, I mean, me and him ended up being good bosom friends. I talked to him the day before they sent him out the country to kill him. We supposed to have a meeting, and he was coming to the University of Maryland for a concert. They had to cancel because he had an infected foot. And he said, I'm not letting nobody touch me till I get to you, man. I know you know what to do. And our relationship, so I refused to do a concert with him. I mean, this would be his opening act at Harvard Yard. And he was making more money in 1 week than I was making in 3 years, man.
Mm.
He was the hottest thing on the planet, huh?
Mm.
He'd go to a stadium, he'd get 200,000 or 300,000 people. I'm in a little old nightclub. That nightclub, you see me out there.
Right.
How many times you think I'd have to work that before
right.
I get the count of 300,000?
Right.
Huh? And so his humanity was so good. His humanity. No arrogance. He got on a plane and came to my house, man. And just humble, really, the respect I have for you, man. And just the fact that you won't work on the show that I'm on. And he said, why, but not a ignorant, sassy why.
Right.
And I said, you got one of the brilliant minds on the planet, one of the social healers. But I can't understand how you can do a song praising the Buffalo Soldiers when the white folks sent them thugs west to kill the buffalo to starve the Indian to death. Hmm?
Mm.
He said, I didn't know that. I said, my grandmother don't know it neither. I wouldn't expect it, her to know it, but you?
Mm.
You should know that, huh?
Mm.
My baby son, man, he wanted to go to Howard University, man. Howard University. He came out of Phillips Academy. They were stunned when at the time he was there, that school in high school had produced 12 presidents. It's 14 now because the two Bush boys, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, had I known they had gone there before I sent my son, I never would have sent him there. I knew the school wasn't no good.
Mm.
But this is like the epitome of education. And every major college, especially minorities, they stand in line and fight for it, because that's when they had to have minorities in the school.
Right.
And they could not believe when he said he was going to Howard University. Hmm? What? When I sent him there, man.
Your son. They couldn't
believe. My son.
Mm-hmm.
I was paying $22,000. Harvard was just charging $19,000.
Mm.
and Harvard would come over there and bring classes over there because they had materials and stuff that Harvard didn't have. So he goes to Howard, and he'd been wanting to go all his little boy life, right? And he called me up crying, man. He said, I can't quit, but I'm not going to wear anything with Howard University name on it. I said, why? He said, because the school is named after a white general, General Howard, and his claim to fame was killing Indian children.
Mm.
And the number one black institution in the world, there's no institution in the world black that has a budget that they have, but it's named after. After a white general who became famous. You know, a good Indian is a dead Indian.
That's right.
You kill them as a baby, they won't grow up.
That's right. Dick, I want to slide in here, and our show ends at about 5 minutes to 10. I wanted to get your observation of the significance of this election. That's the election day, November 6th, and just what did the election of President Barack Obama mean to the white supremacists that you alluded to a while ago when you used the term white supremacy? What did that mean to them? And how much of that do you see, have you seen in this election process leading up to next Tuesday?
There come certain things that become bigger than a white supremacist. Becomes bigger than you. I'm asking the president.
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me explain to you what I mean. On election day, I'm going to vote, right? And then I'm going to get in my car, and I'm going to drive down to the Capitol. Have you ever been to D.C. and seen the Capitol?
Yes.
You know that Indian that's on the top?
Yes, sir, right on the top.
On the top. Abraham Lincoln put him there. And the ceremony, when they unveiled it, was December the 2nd. December the 2nd is the day that John Brown was hanged. I said, okay, I didn't know Lincoln was that hip, huh?
Mm.
And then I'll get in my car and leave there, and I'll drive down to Harper's Ferry and thank John Brown's spirit.
Mm.
And then I'll go from there to Charlestown, West Virginia, which it wasn't named West Virginia, it was just Virginia. There. And I'll go to that courtroom where they brought him out on December the 2nd. And he walked down the steps, and they said, you have anything to say? And he said, if what I'm being hanged for, if I was doing this for the benefit of rich white men, I'd be your hero. Not belligerently, you know what I'm saying? Just said it. And then I'll walk down them steps till I hit the street. Then I'll turn left. And I walk two blocks, then I'll turn right and I walk three blocks, and I'll be at that tree still there that they hanged him, and I just hug it and say thanks. Now, I say that, I usually go there on my birthday, then I go there on October the 16th, that's when the raid, and then I go back there on December the 2nd when they hanged him. But I'm going on election day to thank him. Now, why am I saying this? We didn't look at just some any old president. We didn't look at that. We had presidents, people qualified to be president ever since we got off the boat.
Right.
See, that's why we're the only people that couldn't stay in slavery. See, most folks don't know slavery was, man, slavery was serious. Do you know nobody in the history of this planet broke the chains of slavery in less than 5,000 years? Huh? 5,000 years, man. Except us.
Mm.
They couldn't keep us 300 years because when that thug came over there, he thought he was stealing workers. He was stealing scientists, huh?
Mm.
I built the pyramid, boy. Huh? I'm the one that told you to call it the Big Dip in the Milky Way. And I'm the one that taught you how to plot, follow them stars. And that's me. There ain't no worker. And so we've always had people who qualified to sit in that White House. The difference is we got television. When President Obama was elected, when he was running, television all over the world. And now he's finishing his first term. So that means anybody on this planet Earth that's 3 years old on the television have seen the most powerful human being in the world that look like me and you.
Mm.
Now, they don't know nothing about black unemployment.
Mm.
They don't know nothing about what have you done for me. All they see is the most powerful human being on the planet don't look like them. Huh? That's what I'm seeing. Damn the PhDs and the education and the money. We've always had that, but we didn't have television to put it over the world, and you
right.
put people on your show. If you didn't put them on, the world wouldn't hear them.
Right.
Okay? And so consequently, that's what I'm going to thank, because once you take the baby out the mother, you can't put it back in. Well, unemployment, I don't have no problem with black folks attacking. I don't have no problem with that. Why? Because if I got a little trifling daddy or a mother or a sister or a brother or a son or daughter that they don't like me and I don't like them and they won that $400 million lobby, somewhere in the pit of my soul, I just think they might bring me a little piece of money back. You understand? Now, these people been winning. I don't expect that now. I don't even know them. But I really, I'm going to be honest with you. Now, this might take you as a shock. If you won that $400 million, I really think you'd pick up the phone.
Oh, yes,
sir. Brother Greg, man. Huh?
Yeah, and that's not just saying it to be saying it. Everybody within range.
You hear me?
Is.
You hear me? The girl that wouldn't even go to the prom with you in high school. Would be at the party and expect you to slip a little check to her. So that goes with the territory. Here's a black man in there. Why wouldn't I expect you, huh? When it rains, why don't I expect my garden to grow, huh?
Dick, hold on a second. Listen, whenever we have you on the radio, the City College radio station, WHCR,
yes.
And even this one, I never give the people an opportunity to call in. I got to give them this opportunity.
You okay?
Let me finish this in two seconds. Go ahead.
That's what I'm going to vote for. That's what I'm going to say thanks for.
Mm.
Something happened. Even the white supremacist children see him. The white supremacists,
yes.
They got to be a little bit less white supremacist, even if they manipulated to put him in. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Even if they know they can control from the time he get up, the time he go to bed, and if he mess up, they'll kill him and shoot him like they did Kennedy. Huh?
Mm.
But my children, the people around the world don't see that. That's what I'm going and vote for.
Mm.
And say thank you, thank you, thank you.
Beautiful.
That's bigger
telephone
than
number. Telephone number 213-943-3618, 213-943-3618. You'll be on the air with Brother Dick Gregory, and we only have a few more minutes left in our show this evening. Communicators on the Keys 107 Network here on Blog Talk Radio, you're welcome to call in with your questions, 213-943-3618. Your observations regarding, and I know you're in D.C. and you're moving around, you can only get it by way of TV and reading papers, your observations regarding the storm that hit the Northeast.
But you know, you said something. That's what makes you so wise, man. There is no language or no film that can tell you the devastation. That's why you see them people on TV, that look they got on their face.
Yeah.
They've seen something that Hollywood can't portray, okay? When I went down to a big, big hurricane that hit Florida, wiped out everything. When I got there, man, you know what it is to see a truck hanging out of a tree like Christmas ornaments you put on your Christmas tree?
Mm.
Something comes over you and you say, wow. I had a friend of mine, man, a tugboat. He had this huge, massive house on the bay. A tugboat 2-4 miles out in the water ended up on his front porch. Okay, so there is nothing that a film or TV cameras can pick up. They can try. That's why you see them folks out there, they're just sitting there, and they know enough from journalism school to be professional, but all that comes away. It's like a woman go to the hospital to have a baby, and she curls her hair and put the makeup on. When that baby get ready to come up, and that makeup falls off your face, them curls fall off your hair, and I saw my wife as the true beautiful woman she was. That's what happens when you go to a scene like that. And we will never, that's what the governor was talking about, huh? You remember he said, I've been going to these places ever since I was a little child?
Yes, yes.
And he almost cried. I didn't recognize. Here's a guy that before that, he was so belligerent. You know, we told you, he was arguing with the mayor of the gambling city. Huh? I told them to do this. When he saw that, you haven't heard his voice. I mean, his voice went up 2 octaves. He sounded like he was a ballerina.
Yeah.
He witnessed something, huh?
Mm.
That only the human eye can see, but you can't tell nobody. Because there's nothing in the language or anything that you can portray. And that's why the kindness came out of him, huh? He looked like a little chubby, fat white boy who we all know. Just as nice and friendly and always have a pocket full of candy, huh? That's what he looked like. That's what he portrayed. And all these thugs that jumping on him, they would do the same thing if they could see that. And when Russ Limbo, do you know what Russ Limbo called him, didn't you? A fat, ignorant Raymond. Now here, well, at least, let's see. If I would, you couldn't say that after you've seen it, but if I could tell him what I thought, if I was him, I'd say, well, I might be fat, I might be ignorant, but I ain't no drug addict. Yeah, I can read some books. I can get rid of this weight. I can read me some books, get me some tutors, and get rid of this ignorance. But see if you get rid of them drugs, that Oxycontin, yeah? And so that's, get back to what you said, that's what. And then you start looking at other things on TV. Katrina, huh?
Yeah.
Katrina. And the dignity. And they didn't say a mumbling word, huh? All of that. All the lies they was telling. They was raping and doing this and doing that and doing this here. Well, as a man, I know about sex. I know when you hungry, you bypass sex.
Yes,
get
sir.
You something to eat.
Yeah.
So you telling me you in a place, you scared, and then they're talking about it was guns. Don't you remember we was looking at them long lines before the hurricane hit, and they said, reading the text along, they searching everybody to make sure no weapons are coming in?
Yeah.
So then why are you telling me there's shooting going on inside? And so then you sit and you look, and I'm looking, and nothing moved that fast. As we see now. Okay? And so that's what happens when you in a big time city that nobody respect New Orleans. I'm not talking about this black folk. You think Queen Elizabeth would ever go to New Orleans and eat some gumbo? Huh? You think them super rich folk, They go to the best restaurants in the world, including them in New York. You think they would go and eat some gumbo? Please. And so, consequently, if something's going to happen to you, let it happen in New York. Big time. But all the big-time stuff didn't work. Shut down. And one of the horror things now that ain't nobody going to be talking about, and that's what your mayor, see, everybody forget before he endorsed the president, he told the president, don't come to my city, didn't he?
Right, that's right.
They'll come later, huh? And yep. Then what changed him? Well, see, in New York, you see these little anti-frame weather people we see on TV?
Yes.
No, New York got the real ones. They don't make no money working for TV. They work for these major corporations, so they tell them they know 2 years ahead of time what's moving, huh?
Yes, sir.
And so evidently one of them boys got to him, or maybe the woman, and told him, said, you know, what all of us know. I'm saying, like me and you, we know all hurricanes started in West Africa, right where the slaves was put on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
There's never been a hurricane that didn't start there. This one started out in the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't figure it out unless, you know, you might know something about weather, but they don't know nothing about that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you heard him talking about, every other word was climate change, climate change, climate change.
Mm-hmm.
They know something happened strange, but they can't figure out what it was. So they just say climate change. Even folks that's been denying it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you stop and think about, and now you're going to see the killing, the suicides. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's nice. It's good conversation. Oh, I got my life. You don't mean that. He says, you know what my son told me, the chiropractor? He said they would study cases of people show up at horrible first responders. Horrible.
Yes.
Accidents. How you feel? I feel fine. So both the guy's legs are gone. But that adrenaline, huh, that's running through your body, that shock that's running through your body, you don't feel nothing, huh? And so when they sit down and realize there's stuff going, they will never get back. Something as simple as a picture, huh?
Oh,
a picture.
Man.
The picture of the baby, huh?
Right.
A picture of you when you was in high school, when you really look good. You know, you like, you kicking the other side of 60 now. You understand? And you could always slip in the closet and pull that. Oh, that's gone. Oh, that's gone. Something. Your gun. I heard this guy say they came in on the first floor and they was looking at it, just kind of laughing. Then it moved up the steps, and the next thing you know, they had to get on the roof to be said, oh, you mean you got a gun that can't help you, huh? All at once, all my nasty talk, all my hatred, all my viciousness, I'm reduced to running from something like water that is not carrying a gun, ain't never been to school to learn how to deal with me. And I'm horrified. And then after I get through, every night I go to bed and I will see that. You see, soldiers come home messed up because somebody they never knew growing up, but their partner got killed and they feel bad. Why did it happen to them? Well,
that's right.
My wife and daughter and my cousin, I grew up with them, and they gone. If a soldier will feel that way about a stranger that he just met in boot camp, what do you think? And that's the next thing they should do, is bring in psychiatrists from all over the world. All over the world. You see, if I had jurisdiction, I mean real power, there wouldn't be no school in none of them districts no more this year. No more this year. You just had a horrible tragedy, huh? To the likes that most of the people in the world have never seen. The number one city in the world shut down. The stock market shut down. And the vibrations that's going through. We talking about people standing in line buying gas. What about the people that ain't got no money to buy no gas?
Man.
What happens, man, when your car, you know, poor folk, they get cars, man, they name it Pepsi.
Yeah.
Pretty Mary. Got their rag, man, they go out, they put their suit on, got their polishing rag in their pocket. They go out there and see something that looked like Frankenstein's cuff.
Mm.
Hmm?
Mm.
All of them trinkets that we had was gone.
Mm.
Huh? Then the family members is gone. And then you're looking at your wife or your husband that be quietly crying for the rest of their life. And every time the thunder hit, every time they say it's going to rain, every time they say it's going to be a storm, me and you don't go through that, huh? But they will. And we so busy, commerce, let's put this back together, Damn school. If I went out in the street and caught serious pneumonia, I go to the hospital, my lungs collapse. I'm out of school for a year and a half, huh? What do you think's going on in those folks' mind? They mind. You saw them on TV, and the real thing come out. Did you hear anybody mention God?
No.
Oh, thank God! I lost myself, but thank God I got see the real stuff. That's why you can be a racist and a Christian, because you know you don't believe in that crap,
no.
Huh? Nobody's ever told you, but you can see it, huh? And as a black person looking, huh, I felt their pain, man.
Yeah.
I felt their pain.
Yes.
You know, see, there comes a time, man, you and I can be on the highway, man, and our car turn over and the babies and all are crying, and that truck driver, he might be a Klan, stop that truck, man, and they'd try to pull that car because he's not into his Klan move now. Something chopped him past that and took him into the humanity.
Yes.
Huh? And so you just sit and you look, and then the time of the year, Thanksgiving right around the corner, Christmas right around the corner, Cold weather right around the corner. See, when you sitting there and looking at Katrina, they didn't have to worry about getting chilly at night, huh?
Mm.
They didn't worry about have their feet been cold, huh? Once the Red Cross brought them some food, huh? Then I was feeling good, man. Bring me a Pepsi Cola, Coca Cola, some lemonade, some Kool-Aid, some sweet tea. But I'm cold, huh? And so again, I sit and I watched it and I just, phew. But I knew what was going to happen because I've been around floods. When they was talking about it, I knew the conditions. See, I've seen it smash stuff. A hurricane, I guess, time me to shut up. When I went to college down in Southern Illinois University, they had a lot of hurricanes down there, and they had this huge tree. No, it's a one of them poles that the Bell telephone put their wires on.
Right,
one of them big poles. A straw had blown all the way through that tree, that pole, and almost came out the other side. And they bring people there and show them that little straw, huh?
The force of the wind.
The force of the wind. Something you can't cuss. Your nuclear bomb. We got the baddest navy in the world. You saw them, got them up out of there, didn't you?
That's right.
And it cost the taxpayers $300 million a day just for the fuel. Them boats was using.
Well, Dick, we are at the end of this interview. I want to thank you very much for joining us and sharing your insights. And in our next interview with you, I'm going to take you back to that levee when you was working on the levee. Let you flesh that story out for us.
Yes.
Okay. And
yes.
Want to thank your family also for facilitating your appearance on the show today.
Thank you.
And just thank you for being you, and God bless you and your family, my brother. Thank you.
Can I say one more word, quickly?
Yes, sir. Yes.
The number two cause of death in America is dehydration, water. That same water that causes all of that same water will keep you alive. The number two cause of death in America is not heart cancer, is dehydration, like a drinking water.
The number one is what?
Number two. Number one, sleep deprivation. Number two, dehydration. Number three, lack of physical fitness. All of them are free gifts from the universe, but we don't have time.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
All right, peace.
Love.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening to The Keys 107
And whenever you are in a position, go into the Keys 107 archive, that is blogtalkradio.com/the Keys 107, and you will go, what you'll see then are the various shows that we have on the network, and you plug into any one of them, and you're going to be rewarded with information that you don't get anywhere else. I want to thank the Keys 107 team for inviting me to be a part of the network, and look forward to our next show with you next Saturday on the Communicators, and next Tuesday with Respect for Life. God bless you all with a wonderful and a fantastic evening.
I didn't hear you.
Oh, Dick, I'm here.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, I thought we tuned off. They said
no,
we
my
had
phone
a question.
No,
can you hear me now?
Oh, wait a minute. We can hear you.
Did you call
me?
Okay,
good.
No, wait a minute. I think we have a caller.
Oh.
Yeah, you got somebody
yeah.
on the phone. I'm sorry. The system dropped down for a moment, but we're back live.
Okay, we're back live, Dick. We have
okay.
a caller on the line. Go ahead.
All right.
Yes, my concern and somewhat of a question is that don't we need to discuss the fact that those folks, these folks, however you want to call them, the globalists, the so-called elite, they have weather weapons. So whether it's the scalar technologies, whether it's the HAARP antenna,
yes.
And let's also deal with the fact that there were some very peculiar aspects of this. Shoot. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, since I'm having a problem, I'm going to get off the line, but there's some very.
No, we hear you. I hear you good. But let me just say this to you.
Let me hear it over the air, please.
Okay.
All right. Okay, Dick.
There's some of us out there that know as much about weather modification as the CIA. This was not the proper platform for me
right.
to get into that. I wouldn't use that station on my brother when people's hurting that don't know anything about this.
Yes, sir.
You know, you one of the few people that know what HAARPs mean. Most folks that heard you say, oh, they don't know what that means. No. We not only know it, we know it used to be located in Katuna, Alaska. They got the new ones now, which is in New Mexico and Idaho. And before you had that mess over there in Japan, the tsunami, that's when you saw where them birds were falling dead and them fish were falling dead. That's when they was testing it. So lots of us know that. This is not the proper platform.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. If you owe me $10,000 and your mother and father were killed in an accident and I come to the funeral, that's not the proper place for me to ask you about my money.
Right.
And so I'm just saying that there's people that's sitting there that's suffering, that done lost everything, and they don't want to hear this. This fool talking that can't nobody... My grandmother don't believe nobody can cause a hurricane or tornado but God, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Huh? And she means that. She really don't believe anybody can do that but God. Hmm? And that same grandmother believed World War III could destroy the planet. I say that universal God that put this planet together, when they get ready to destroy it, they don't need no help from some thugs that can put a little bomb together. And if you take
indeed.
The poorest woman on the planet with no education, no money, and that 9 months pregnancy is over, that baby gonna fall if it means death to the mother and the child. You take all the mighty armies that ever existed in the history of the planet, they cannot open up her legs and take that army and keep that baby in her. There's certain things that we can do, and there's certain things that you better not even try. Huh? You heard of Atlantis? But nobody want to tell you what caused it.
All right, Dick, we are at the end. That call they facilitated, but we're absolutely at the end. And once again, I thank you, and I thank the caller for asking the question and your response.
Yes.
Very important. Thank you, my brother.
Thank you.
All right, peace. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much once again. Thank you. God bless you all. And do support the Keys 107 Network by listening and telling your friends and relatives that we are on the air when we're on the air. God bless you all. Good night.
Winners, everyone must play fair. All you beginners know that you've got to start somewhere. Some fool might see the light.